It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott's here. Richard Campbell's here. Of course, we're going to do a after-action analysis of Microsoft Build. Now that it's over, what did it all mean? And what was the highlight? I think we all agree. What was the low light? I think we all agree. We'll also talk about new Windows 11 preview builds. And Paul convinces me to go back in the Insiders program. The reasons why may surprise you. All coming up next on Windows Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell, episode 831, recorded Wednesday, May 31st, 2023. Skied both and drunk in the middle. Windows Weekly is brought to you by ACI Learning. IT skills outdate in about 18 months. Stay ahead of the curve and future-proof your business competitiveness with customizable, entertaining training. Fill out the form at go.acilearning.com/twit for more information on a free 2-week training trial for your team. And by Lenovo, orchestrated by the experts at CDW to help transform your organization with Lenovo ThinkPads, equipped with the Intel Evo platform for effortless connectivity and collaboration from anywhere. Learn more at cdw.com/Lenovo client.
Larry Sanders Show.
I love the Larry Sanders Show.
Oh, my God. It might be literally the best show ever.
Yeah, he goes, we're on in 2-1.
Yeah, but they just did a retrospective.
From Hollywood. I love that
I guess
show.
one of the things they used to do to keep it going was they would just start recording. Like, he would just start talking, and then everyone else was like, oh, crap, we got to go.
Oh, that's cool.
And it would
cool.
just, it would make it seem
Oh, so you
real,
mean they actually, you know? In the recording, would do that. Wow, that's awesome. Yeah. Good for them.
Yep.
It's time for Windows Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Microsoft. It worked.
No one will ever know why that was great.
That's Paul Thurrott. I cracked him up, ladies and gentlemen, from Thurrott.com. And his books are at leanpub.com. From Run As Radio, it's Red Flannel Guy. Mr. Rich Campbell. That's hysterical.
I put the flannel on today because we're talking Canadian whiskey today, and I thought it was good. Legit.
He's a lumberjack, and he's okay.
We're going to explain why we're super contrasty today.
Why are you super contrasty today?
Oh, it looks kind of weird, doesn't it?
I don't know.
Oh, the whole thing.
The other thing I notice is that you part your hair on the left and Rich parts it on the right. That's the only thing I notice.
Works.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of perfect. The reason I'm aware of that, I went to my hairdresser, hair barber, whatever, the person who cuts my hair last week. And I said, is my hairstyle fuddy-duddy? Do I look like an old man? She says, no. Which means, yes.
Yeah.
So I said, can we do different? She said, well, you could part it on the other side. I said, sold.
I went, this was not the most recent time, but maybe 2 or 3 times ago, I went in and she kind of looked at my hair and she said, so where do you part this exactly? And I said, let me help you with that
obvious?
Question. Where do you think your part is?
Now I'm dealing with the hairdresser retired and sold her place, and it was bought by a group of Iraqi men of all things.
Oh,
so I went back there, and the Iraqi fellow cut my hair, and he goes, "Oh, you have very beautiful hair."
In Iraq, that's a normal.
I used to go to
the men hold hands on the street too, so it's okay.
This Asian guy back in Boston, he's cut my hair, and he said, "He goes, I make you look like Paul Newman." Paul Newman's dead, buddy.
Exactly. Precisely my point.
Maybe could we pick someone who's alive?
Hey, we're here not to talk about hair, although as fascinating a conversation as that might be, we are here to talk about Microsoft and Windows. And here we are, post-build.
I know I'm hungover.
Yeah.
In the midst of one of these,
a lot of the weekend looking at videos, session videos.
Oh, catching up. Yeah. In the midst of these, I think it's sometimes a little hard to assess what we're seeing, but I always like to do a post-mortem. That's probably a bad way to put it. It's not dead yet. Yeah.
A triage, if you will.
Somebody said, don't call it a post-mortem. Call it an after-action report.
There you go.
What's the after action report on Build?
Yeah, I've been interested to see people's different reactions. Richard last week, I think, referred to it as one of the best builds in memory, right?
Best keynote.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, as a conference maker, of course, I have concerns about conferences at all times, but
sure.
For me, it is very unusual to have a single theme keynote come out of Microsoft. That's odd for a company that makes hundreds of products to clearly align everything with theme. And some of the product teams I know were pushed out of the keynote entirely and said, like, you and not only are not in the keynote, you can't talk about your stuff this week. You have to wait till Build is over.
Yeah, actually, there was going to be a session about the Windows 11 Explorer redo and all the tech that was going on with that, and they quietly dropped right off the
push it all back.
Wow.
But I would also say the least on time keynotes I've ever seen.
I know. What the heck was that?
Yeah, so strange,
crazy.
They actually threw me day two because they were a little late on day one, and so I came in at my leisure. And there's Paul sitting there, and there's Satya going, or I guess it was wasn't Satya, it was
Panos.
Before Panos, so the Rajesh Shah.
You know, he has beautiful hair too, by the way. And and I thought, oh,
that's good because you can't hear anything he's saying to stare at his hair.
Yeah, I liked day two better than day one. I thought both were very good. I agree. It was a little weird. We kind of thought this, and maybe now I'd like to know if you consider it the case that Panos kind of got the rug pulled out from under him.
Like he did.
You've confirmed it. Okay.
Yeah, two different people. Based on what I was talking about last week, contacted me. I didn't reach out to anybody. Two different people from Microsoft contacted me about that.
And they said essentially that he was going to do some of the stuff that ended up going into day one, and as a result had very little to say in day two. Is that what?
Yeah.
But did he not know it was coming? Like, why would he just compress his piece?
Yeah, it happened last minute. And, how bad would it look if this guy's was on the schedule to do this thing and then did almost nothing, right? I mean, it would have, I give him some credit for going out gamely and just doing it, I guess. But as we noted at the time, not great.
No.
But
it's not a thing to wing.
No. I really like the amount of Windows content at the show. I like that they talked about Windows broadly. There's some stuff coming soon. There's some stuff coming later this year. And then to Richard's point about the all-in on AI thing, I mean, I don't think I've seen Microsoft line up like this since the internet tidal wave or whatever. Awoken a sleeping giant.
And can we give kudos to Stephen Batich?
Oh, my God.
Absolutely. His 10 minutes are the best 10 minutes of both days.
I think that was his coming out party for a lot of people who didn't know who he was or still maybe don't know who he is.
I always knew him as Panos' demo monkey, for God's sake.
Well, he was he's Hinge Boy, right? The guy that makes all the hardware, right? I'll give you a story. So I'll condense this down, but we were at a Surface event, 5 years ago or something. Oh, no, I know exactly what it was. It was when they came up with the Surface Book. And Surface Book, has that giant kind of teardrop hole in it. And they talked about how this spot, whatever. And I said, well, aren't you concerned about stuff falling in there and whatever? So I got him. I saw him at the event. I pulled him over. I said, hey, Stevie. I said, come on. Clearly, you intend to close the gap on this thing eventually. Like, you're acting like this is the design, like, like you wanted. But really, this is the first iteration toward this thing. And he goes, oh. Yeah, totally. I mean, obviously, and then this woman comes over. She's like, all right, Stevie, that's enough of that. She's pulling this out. And it's like every once in a while, you just get like a straightforward answer out of someone's mouth and then they pull them away.
They pull them in.
Yeah,
that'll totally enough of that. It's very funny.
Hinge Boy Stevie.
He's great.
But incidentally, obviously, Microsoft has put these on their site. And we have, if you go to twit.tv/news, our coverage of both day one and day two. And if you only had maybe 20 minutes, watch that very end piece on day two that Stevie Batich lays out the vision for AI, right?
So 2 days of keynotes, 3 hours of keynotes probably, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this guy that virtually no one has heard of or knows at the very end gave a 20-minute, maybe 15-minute talk and completely encapsulated how they're going to roll out AI across the stack.
Like, have you ever wondered why folks are called technical fellow at Microsoft? Because every single TF I've ever worked with can do that thing. Why they've never let him do that before on stage, I can't imagine.
And he did to AI what I just described with Service Book, which was he actually showed, he's like, here we are now, and this is not the end. Normally when you release a product, you're like, look, let's just focus on this, right? This is this is what we're doing. We're not talking about the future. We're not, but he was like, no, this is step one of three. And
here's the path.
Thank you for that. And that's, honestly, I think a developer show, Build in particular, that's really what it's about, right? It's about the future.
And it's the confidence. Like, I wish that was part of day one, for the confidence to the press to say, we're not winging this. We have a plan.
That's right.
Now, we know they're winging it. Like, that's a different thing, but they made a plan.
Yeah. Right. No, but you look right. That's right.
It's like you have a roadmap, but you don't plan which hotels you're going to stay in every night. Mm. So it's a little, both, right?
Right.
And there's no, and to be clear, like, there's no real way to know how this is going to emerge. What excited me about the whole thing overall was Microsoft doing their actual playbook, which is we build ecosystems. That's right. We're excited to see what you're going to do with this ecosystem, where you're going to take it. And we're going to be here to facilitate all of that. And I don't know. We haven't had a message that clear in a while like that.
Well, it goes to your Bill Gates quote about the definition of a platform. Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, but that was Satya, wasn't it? Who was it that pulled that out of the hat? It was day one.
Was Satya said,
I think it was Satya. Someone, and it was maybe it was the guy after Satya, but it was interesting because it's an old quote, but it really set the table for saying
that's who we are.
We're a platform company. Are. Yeah.
This is what we do. Exactly.
And I love that. I mean, that's what they're best at.
Yeah. It's important because there's been a lot of, wobble from here, time and again or whatever, where they kind of look like they're going to stop doing that, right? When they do something like Office 365 that becomes Microsoft 365, you can kind of view it as, well, they're cutting out some partners here. This used to be something that partners did, you know? Mm-hmm. And you get this, like, are they doing an Apple thing? Are they slowly getting rid of this partnering ecosystem or whatever? But then they come out with something like this and you realize, like, no, this is what we do. We're not keeping it all for ourselves. You know, we're not trying to go a little alone. We're going to be a partner to you, and we're going to give you the technology you need to succeed, yada yada yada. I mean, it's
and I would argue it's the first truly Azure centric ecosystem play they've made. They've moved a bunch of other existing platform pieces into the cloud, and often you have choices as to where you're going to run them and so forth. But the only way you get GPT-4 is to run it off of Azure. Like, that's reality. And so here it is. They finally have a product utterly dependent on Azure that has compelling in an ecosystem.
Right.
So they didn't say Windows 12. I know Paul had that on his bingo card.
Yes. And he put it right in the middle, too. So there goes a whole lot of bingos.
But I didn't win a single round. But,
so Satya at the beginning said 50 plus. We got 50 plus AI announcements this week at Build. Right. I'm going to give you five. And one of them was Windows Copilot. I mean, he did say that. I mean, I guess that's what Windows 12 would be.
Well, no. So actually, if you go back, going back to the Stevie Batish thing, Copilot is Windows 11 because it's a thing on the side.
It's still a sidebar.
Windows 12 is where it becomes more fully integrated and is that middle piece where it's, what is it, beside, inside?
Inside.
I wrote down because I thought it was so good. I actually took notes on Steve and Stevie, I guess you call him. And I don't know him that well, but I call him Steve. But I will summarize, if you wish.
Yeah, please.
The flow. Mm-hmm. Let's see. So this is that was Kevin Scott. Oh, maybe I'm still on day one. Let's go back.
Day one.
Yeah. Let's go back.
It's like Kevin Scott, Yusuf Mehdi. We're here somewhere.
Yusuf Mehdi, Kevin Scott. And then Goo.
That's all day one. That was the end of day one.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Day two comes after day one, doesn't it? Here you go. Stevie Batish, Technical Fellow, Microsoft's Applied Sciences Group. Actually, put this up on the screen. AI is the new interaction technology. And that's kind of one of the things they've been saying is...
Leo, I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt. What is this thing we're looking at?
This is my note-taking.
What is this not Notion?
Well, Notion is not great for, you know, like fast note taking. So I use Logseq, L-O-G-S-E-Q.
AI's new interaction technology, less programmatic, more piloted. So this is the three stages, he says, of AI. Beside, which is that sidebar, the helper alongside your app. It's your first AI experience, and it's minimally disruptive. I'm sorry, the text is so small, I can't make it bigger. Inside is the next stage, and this is what you're talking about. This is Windows 12. AI is the main scaffolding of the app. It's, and he says it. So remember, again, I think it was on day one, they showed Douglas Engelbart's mother of all demos where we first saw the mouse, right? And the connection of the pointer on the screen to your hand moving. And really, ever since GUIs, all programs have had a main loop that is, what's the mouse doing? What's the keyboard doing? What's the mouse doing? What's the keyboard doing?
It's literally a video game.
They call it the event loop. They call it the event loop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He says the new loop, the main input loop, is going to be the AI loop, less dependent on point and click, fewer toolbars, fewer deep menus. Can't hate that, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that in a bit. But yeah,
and then finally, outside, where and this is a little scary. This is what all the Sam Altman and everybody just wrote that note. Extinction event.
AKA Skynet. Yeah.
It's AI executes globally. In other words, it's no longer trapped inside an app or inside Windows, but it is the executing everywhere, orchestrating multiple apps, acting as your agent. Mm-hmm. It's Jarvis. It's Bing Orchestrator, he calls it, or Windows Shell is an orchestrator.
Except in the end, what it is just a set of ruled APIs that these agents can access.
Right.
Now, if one of them happens to be the nuclear codes, okay, that's on you. Like, I wouldn't publish that API. It's just me, but I'm saying.
Yeah, don't, please.
They're talking about is exposing APIs. Right?
I made a note, the final thing he said, which I thought really is the kind of overarching point, which is use AI to reach your customers' goals, not their tasks. Don't focus on getting a task done. Go a step higher and say, what are you trying to do?
This is a message for developers, you're saying.
Yeah.
In other words, yeah.
Yeah. What are you trying to do? And let me help you do that, not individual tasks. It's going to take some getting used to. Wasn't that clippy?
The one thing he talked about in the middle part of that was this notion that UIs would get simpler because AI was there to get it done. And that was and that's why I said, let's just hold off on that part because it's a little complicated. Like today, we don't have AI in Windows. So Microsoft goes through a process in Windows 11 where they simplify the user interface, which is valuable and useful. But we've got that one. Every person has that one thing they need and it's not there anymore. And everyone complains kind of problem. Right. And so we all know the stories about the taskbar and everything. But I think the goal here would be that UIs can be simpler because we just don't need those controls anymore because it will just be something that is done for us more seamlessly, you know, whatever that thing is, right? So, you know, we went from toolbars and menus to ribbons in Office, and we went from, you know, this traditional desktop UI to a traditional desktop UI in Windows, but one that is, you know, simpler, I guess. We'll see how that goes. I mean, we in the Microsoft community have kind of suffered from don't take my feature away, you know, don't move my feature to a new location. We hate that too.
Well, and Microsoft, especially the Windows team, has been consistently punished every time they try.
Yeah. 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 I mean, and the earliest thing that they tried along these lines, well, not the earliest,
was Bob,
the most recent thing.
Right?
Sorry. I was going to say, not the earliest. Sorry. remember they were going to do this Windows 10X thing. And of course that UI is what they eventually brought into Windows 11. A key component of Windows 10X, which is a completely different kind of simplification, was, Win32 isolation.
Right.
This notion that, we're going to make the system more reliable as well when we do this. And that kind of fell apart, but I don't know if anyone noticed this. There's a feature coming in the next version of Windows 11 called Win32 isolation. Right. And it's not the same thing. It technically, they're not using containers. That's not what it is. But I always said about that feature, to me, that was just as exciting, if not more so than the UI, that if they could get this thing to work, this is how we bring Windows into the 21st century, basically, you know.
Do you think they're going to invert it now that for me as an admin, I can apply isolation per app rather than them saying everything is isolated, try and undo it?
I do. Yeah.
And that's the logical thing to do.
Yes. And it, you know, without knowing if there's someone like Mark Vizanovich who does this to me a lot, will say, Paul, those two things have nothing to do with each other. But then I would read the high level explanation both. I'll say, you know, I hear you, but they sound exactly the same to me.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as it accomplishes the same goal, I always thought that was a great idea. And what I mean by that is not the exact implementation using containers, but rather this notion of isolating these things from each other and making Win32 apps safe and eliminating that problem.
You know, just being able to limit the ability for any given piece of code to call to other pieces of code.
Yeah.
You need a manifest.
A lot of times it's not malicious. It's just stupid, right? Poorly written. But then again, those APIs are terrible. So it's no one's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's malicious, obviously.
Yeah.
Anyway,
there's no question this is a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
I think no question that Microsoft's tried it before and failed.
Yeah. But Leo, you know, we do these things not because they are easy. We do them because they are hard.
No. We do them because we thought they were going to be easy.
Nice. Yep. Well, we tend to make ourselves look better than we are. So that's
interesting. It's really interesting. But at least of all the speakers, he was the most very clear in the vision and the roadmap. And I think it was a really excellent presentation.
Yeah.
And an exhortation to developers to do it this way, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think to see that there's a roadmap for it. It's like you're not going to be done with just this one little thing. There's going to be more stages to it. And really what he's making a commitment to Microsoft is we're going to expose more interfaces, ways for you to integrate and for it to be, you know, to integrate into your applications and be more effective. And you're not going to be responsible for trying to build all those hooks. We'll do it.
Yeah.
Right. I can't wait to see what this looks like from a developer perspective. I mean,
survives contact with reality, right?
Well, like that was exactly my question. I mean, is it possible that they are overestimating the value of that AI brings? And because I think there's some question.
That's a hard one because it's a case-by-case basis, right? So you have a guy that makes it's a stupid thing I do, the little text editor. Is there some way that AI makes that app better? That's a different conversation than you have this other.
Well,
there are going to be people who come into this.
You know, so look, you understand very well exactly what's required for that.
Yeah.
Paul's notepad.
Right.
Could AI help there?
It could, right? So if you're using an app like that to create text-based content, all those same tools that you see in the AI or the Edge sidebar or in Bing up on the web or whatever it is, where you say, hey, look, I need to write a letter. I need it to be formal. I need it to be short. I need it to be concise and to the point. And I'm leaving my job. I always do that one example for some reason, but it's like, I'm leaving my job. I want to write a letter to my boss and my colleagues.
It's a little Freudian. Okay.
It's 2023. We all want to do this. And it generates this thing. And then you use that editor to keep going with it, hopefully.
Yeah, partly the reason you do that is because you don't really give a damn how anodyne or insightful it is. You're not trying to...
No, I'm used to... Don't worry about the specific example. The only point was just that you're creating a document.
But you wouldn't use it to write your novel or a great essay.
But you know what? What people would... Are you telling me they wouldn't?
A generic business document. Sure.
Listen... Yeah. I love Stephen King. He's written some of the best books I've ever read in my life. He doesn't know how to end a book to save his life.
Oh, maybe
he could use AI
to the end.
Here's the story. Tell me how to bring it together at the end.
Tell me how to end this.
Yeah. AI endings to Stephen King's King books would be a cottage industry.
You're missing the obvious one, which is we need a machine learning model for J.R.R. Martin and try and finish those down.
Yes, exactly.
Oh my God. Game of Thrones, please. Right, just finish volume 6.
And you
six.
Would say, make it better than the TV show, and the AI would just laugh and say, low bar.
Hodor. No AI would ever come up with Hodor. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a good thing. All right, what else? So it's not Windows 12 yet, but...
No, I think we've got... I have a theory at the end here about the schedule and all that, but I think Windows 11 will be the beside interface for AI, right? The old thing that gets tacked on with AI, right? There's going to be a lot of that. Some of that stuff is coming soonish. Some of it's coming later this year, what we'll call 23H2. Microsoft keeps mucking up. I shouldn't say it that way. Effing up. No. they keep changing the way that they deliver things, even since we've talked last time.
Yeah.
It seems like every time I look at a blog post, there's a new thing. There's a new goofy thing. So, for example, this is kind of apropos of nothing in a way, but in addition to the preview releases we were talking about, remember the Week D preview releases? I just got to bring this up so I can see what it was called. There was something last week called a Windows configuration update. Came out on the same day, I believe, as that preview update for next month's Moment 3 release. And it enabled Moment 3. So now there's something new called a Windows configuration update. Guys, seriously, stop. Like how many? I can't remember this many terms, you know, let alone figure out how to differentiate them. And when you look forward to things like Moment 3 or 23H2, which I believe will be Moment 4, basically, but probably two things that kind of sit by side and are delivered at the same time. So to the user, they're just the same thing. You can't say with any certainty how any of those things are going to be released, because honestly, it seems like every time there's something new, it's a new way to do it. They might have, it's like they opened some kind of a nexus to like another dimension. Now they can just throw stuff into it. It comes out on the other side. No one has any idea how it got there. Anyway, so that's my little stupid part of the world, I guess.
Now this next line, I'm not sure what this all means. Dev drive, dev home. Are these tools?
Yeah.
Is this their?
This is some of the Windows announcements that came out of.
Oh, so this was right, later. So for example, this was. I guess I saw Dev Drive. Yeah.
Dev Drive, right. This is the RAFS thing. That's great. That's an excellent idea.
Explain for people who didn't watch. RAFS.
RAFS. So this is the resilient file system.
RAFS.
Yeah. This came up out of the Synofsky group, Windows 8 timeframe. It was going to take over for NTFS because we have to get rid of everything we didn't invent. And, you know, that was the thing at the time. And when Windows 10 kind of came around, RAFS went forward in server, I guess. It was not really a thing on the client. I don't mean to say it wasn't there. I mean, you didn't see it take over for NTFS. You didn't, you know, it's not something we were all using. But anyway, they're using RAFS for the dev drive. So this is something they configured for you. So you don't have to go into Disk Manager and shrink the drive, add the drive, format it as RAFS. You know, it just does it for you. And this is something I think they should do for consumers. Well, they should just do this for everybody. You know, put all your OneDrive stuff on RAFS and make that faster too. Why wouldn't I want everything to be fast? It's supposed to be significantly faster than NTFS. And it's specifically for, I don't know if this has something to do with like the specifics of, you know, GitHub and, you know, Visual Studio projects or whatever, but apparently it's dramatically faster.
You always have this battle between I have very large files and I have lots of little files.
Exactly. Which is the type of thing you would see in a GitHub repo or if it was a developer.
And you know what? It's hard to make a file system that's good at both. It's just one of those schisms.
Right. So maybe that is it. Maybe it's RAFS is optimized for lots of small files versus some big files.
Versus managing really massive files.
Yeah. So I think that's cool. That's a good feature. Dev Home, which is just an app, you can get it now. It's available in preview in the Microsoft Store, which maybe is a hint about how sophisticated it's going to be. To me, hits at a weird place because I feel like developers have their ways of doing things and that they have ways of configuring a system to be exactly what they want, and they don't necessarily sit there and manually configure features like in a UI like you or I might. And this is part of what this thing will do is kind of help with that. It lets them. It's almost like a visual front end to Winget in some ways, where they just select the apps they want to install.
It's more about you end up working on more than one project, and sometimes even for different companies, and so configurations can be very different from each other, and it's a pain in the butt to maintain separation between them. Like you really want it. You end up with separate copies of Studio, literally. I've gone so far as to have separate VMs in some cases.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I know some people would probably use like a preview version over here just to have a different version of it, so it could be side by side or something.
Yeah.
So, so this is kind of addressing the freelancing world of the present.
When you're working for a given company, it's like, hey, I have the new project I'm working on, but I'm still maintaining that old project. And there's enough difference between them that trying to use a shared environment creates more problems than it solves. And so more and more this mentality of for this project, this box kind of thing. But now the box is more for as small a footprint as it can be.
Windows 365 was less expensive. That would be a viable solution for that.
Yeah.
Especially if you needed a GPU or something,
Well, and also when you get into lots of remote work where it's like, hey, I don't actually want you to have the source code on your machine. So I'm going to have you,
you can you use know, a Chrome virtualize button, using some awesome virtual machine on the back end.
Big punch machine back there, which is always correctly configured and, you know, and it keeps local store.
I'll just make this prediction. I think Windows Copilot either fades away or is improved dramatically. And they've done this a lot. Terminal.
I'm afraid they missed the boat. I think M365 Copilot's going to win the day because that's where the info worker actually is. Windows Copilot has the possibility to be even larger than that, but you need to be on it. And although now, didn't Panos say samples or demos in June?
Yeah, like that imminently? Meaning you'll see it in the Insider program, right?
Okay, so it'll start appearing in the Insider. I mean, it's the end of May
It's going to be 2 weeks,
And that's at least pretty prompt. The real challenge you've got here is what will make Windows Copilot compelling is how many third-party products work.
That's right.
Will work with it.
So, yes, and that's why I have this in the maybe category, because I have to say right off the bat, some of the stuff they showed was kind of interesting, right? Obviously, I don't think anyone's going to sit down at a computer and say, make this computer more efficient for work. Right. You know, which is sort of what they said. And it's like, oh, you can try like a focus session. You can put on dark mode. Whatever. And it's like, okay, that's cute. I do like the file drag thing where it could give you a summary and have some other functions related to that. I think that's actually really kind of a neat thing. But then again, you know, it's like these are just little cute things. Like they're kind of like little ideas. And it's like, okay, that's fun. But I agree with you. I think the real power of this, and unfortunately, they didn't have the greatest demos of it. The first one they did was a Spotify demo, which I thought was stupid. But I think the real point of showing Spotify was that it was this third-party app integration.
Yeah, right? It was a third-party app integration that people recognized. That's what it came across to me. But it was like, hey, seriously, you know what this icon is.
Play me music that's good for work. Like, okay. But the second one was better. I don't know that a lot of people understood it, but not that it's super complicated, but it was specific. It was just, I need to create a graphic for my business or whatever it was. And it brought up Adobe Express and that's cool. And then I have to share it with the team and it brought up Teams. You know? And so Teams obviously is not a third party app, but the idea was you've got this chain of tools you're using and you don't really have to think about the tool, which goes back to that thing we talked about, document-centric interfaces, right?
Well, and more goal-centric work versus task-centric work.
Yeah.
But I just can't wait to see kind of battles are going on inside of Microsoft for which app gets prompted, right?
Like, well, that's
and that's not our problem. Like, I'm glad it isn't.
And is there going to be a way where, you know, we have this notion of default apps today? We're going to have a much bigger selection of those, and they're going to have to integrate with that. When I say I want to create a graphic, it needs to know that I'm using Photoshop or Adobe Express or Affinity, whatever. And you know, will it allow for that? Is it going to be that smart?
From an IT perspective, it's like, here is the specified set of apps for this organization. These are the ones you suggest. Do not suggest this. We don't use it.
Right.
Big speed up, though. I'm looking at this graph from the Visual Studio blog that somebody put up in Discord.
And then, so you notice Git is 41%, the big one.
Yeah.
Biggest one. And that kind of doesn't surprise me. Although I guess you would use Git with .NET, Java, or Python, I suppose. But that's interesting. We talked about this, I think we did, right? That this notion, like, why isn't Git just part of Windows? Like, why isn't this?
They've chosen to keep it a wholly owned subsidiary, I think largely for political reasons.
Oh, God, yes.
I
mean, just look
it. But put it in Windows. But put it in Windows.
But you can still incorporate it in. Yeah.
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 I mean,
I thought the Windows team would get all over Emacs. The Electron guys.
Right? It's in my Emacs. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. And then,
there was also this notion of I think it's called WinGet config, where you use a YAML file.
Which love is kind this, of
a,
right?
A very simple XML format for config. You know, for
Reproducible builds. Well, this is huge.
And, you know, install, like, in other words, using WinGet to install. So
not just install, config the whole thing, right? So you.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Install, config, and keep up to date, right? Yep. So it's like kind of install, config, and manage, I guess. But but again, I'm a little confused that Microsoft hasn't come out with a GUI for WinGet to make it more mainstream. In fact, I don't understand why the Windows Store, the Microsoft Store, isn't the GUI for WinGet, right? we have these two kind of data stores for apps. I mean, maybe this could be one thing.
Yeah. You know, I feel like it's different teams, different motivations. Yeah. There's going to be a schism there.
Yep.
Still a great idea. And, you don't have this in most operating systems. Even there are some Linux distros that have reproducible builds, but a lot of people use Ansible and things like that to try to do it. Mm-hmm. I think it's something developers love, the idea. It's not a mainstream idea because most people don't have 15 machines they want to set up or move from machine to machine.
I do.
You and I do. I have a .files config that I put on GitHub and download and run every time I get.
Nobody finds religion until something goes wrong, and it's
until they have the pain.
There's a little feature. I don't think it's anywhere in the notes per se. Well, you know, it's later. We mentioned a little bit, but stupidly they're calling it Windows Backup. But there's this notion of we're going to back up your settings and your app installs for store apps only and some other things. And when you go through the UBI in the beginning, when you set up a new computer, you can more easily restore more stuff at once and you get back to where you were, that kind of thing. Right. It's obvious. They've taken away some of those features. Now they're bringing back more. They're going to have more now. So that's great. It's a really good idea. You shouldn't have to explain to people why that's important, but if your computer is configured correctly and everything's stored in the cloud and you have your SSD goes up and nothing works anymore, you should be able to sign into a computer. And after some few minutes, go into your exact desktop where everything's exactly where you left it and you just get back to work, you know? And it's sad that people need to experience a hardware failure before they say, you know, I really need something like that. And so I'm hoping by putting this just kind of into Windows, making it a part of Windows, and I should say, you know, parenthetically again, right. That more people will use it and it will work hopefully. So we'll see. It's important.
Have you ever used it? You
only need it once.
Have you learned Ansible, Richard? Have you ever used it? Because
I know what it is.
Yeah, I keep flirting with the idea of it's just a lot of, you know, it's one of those things where you could automate it and then you wouldn't have, it'd be easier from then on, but it's a lot of work to do that.
Yeah.
Or just keep typing the same commands every single time. And
I went down the box starter chocolatey path.
Right? Chocolatey is the same, is similar. Yeah.
Yeah.
Winget gets you half the way there.
Is that Winget gets you all the way there eventually. I think that's what
I think that's their plan, right? And there's another reason for reproducible builds, because then you have consistency. So if something does go wrong, you know, you don't have, oh, is it something weird about this configuration, or am I missing a library here, or you know, that's a real pain for developers. So I think this is
stuff
great.
That doesn't come up, right?
Yep. I hope they continue forward. Sally Forth, as it were. Finally, you said you wanted to close this segment with your prognostications.
Yeah. Actually, we skipped one thing, though. We should just speak briefly about this 1 billion thing. Mm-hmm. They said this on stage. They wrote a big blog post about it. The blog post is called Delivering Delightful Performance for More Than 1 Billion Users Worldwide. And then it's a post about Windows 11. And Windows 11 does not have more than 1 billion users worldwide. Now, if you look at what they actually write in the post, Windows does. But here's the thing. Windows a year ago had 1.4 billion users.
Right.
In 2018, it had 1.5 billion users. You know, in 2015, it had 1.5 billion users. So the two questions there are, well, A, do you mean Windows 11? No, right. It's Windows 10 and Windows 11, because when they say Windows, they're talking about supported versions of Windows, which today are those two versions. Okay. And if you kind of do the math on it based on stat counter type stats, it's roughly 2/3 of those are Windows 10 and 1/3 are Windows 11. So neat. But what's going on with the number? How did the number go down, you know? And so all we can do is use the language they provide. Back when they were talking about 1.4 billion, it was active device. It's monthly active devices. That's not the same thing as users, right? I sort of think of that as like actual PCs out in the world. Obviously, some people have two PCs. You use a work PC and a home PC, whatever it might be. It was also a long time ago, so the world has changed. You know, where everyone wasn't working at home at that point. Also, it was Terry Myerson, so they were counting phones and Xboxes and HoloLenses because that guy's
they were counting Windows kernels.
Right? Yeah, he was going to get paid more if they had more. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, that's another story. But When they have used the number, when they have used the term users, which they've actually done a few times, it's actually pretty consistent. So it's kind of an interesting thing. I would have thought it was a higher number, but between Windows 10 and Windows 11, there are, in fact, well, according to Microsoft, there are over 1 billion users, roughly 324 million of which are on Windows 11, which is, you know, artificially limited because they're not letting some people upgrade because of the hardware requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, those would be all, otherwise that would all be the same Windows version.
Well, and it's still not real enterprise friendly. I have a right. show in the can now with Johan Aridmark. It'll come out in a few weeks. It's specifically about, okay, in the enterprise, how do we roll out 11?
What does it take?
Well, and look, MDT, the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, not supported.
Right.
Right. If you're running Configuration Manager, fine. But if you're running Configuration Manager, you're a big organization.
Sure.
And if you're trying to try and do it with Intune and Autopilot, well, there's a few caveats. Like it's, they have not made it easy for an enterprise. If you've got 300 seats and you're trying to talk about getting to 11, you're in trouble. Like there's no way you're running ConfigMan. MDT's gone away. Intune's too slow. Like there's no simple solutions.
I have to think, and this is just kind of ties into what we've been talking over the past several shows now, I guess, that this is purposeful on Microsoft's part. That they really want to do some things with Windows 11 that they know will be semi-controversial. They want to make it simpler, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And they know that's not going to fly in the enterprise. And so they're giving a few years where they can kind of play around with these ideas, throw stuff out in the world, see how it goes. And they're slowly going to kind of scale back where they're almost basically Windows 10. I mean, it won't be exactly the same. But at some point, this thing will hit that point where it's acceptable to the enterprise by and large. And hopefully that will coincide.
I think you're right. And this is the sort of the conclusion we came to in the show is... Microsoft is encouraging us to test now so that we can push back on the fact of, hey, this isn't the path. Like you may need to give us an MDT to Win 11 solution because a lot of people are depending on it. They'd love to retire that software.
I think
this is the usual exploration. There's a half a dozen paths. Can we only support two of them?
Save ourselves
some money.
And on the enterprise end, I mean, those guys, there are people testing Windows 11, of course, and their answer was a hard no in the beginning, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And it's probably softened a little bit, and maybe by this time next year, I'll be like, okay,
we're getting there. I mean, to be clear, for the really big orgs, for 1,000+ seats, folks that will run SCCM, there's a clear path,
right?
And part of this, you know, is a subtext of what's my life in run as. It's like, how hostile to you are you to the 100 to 500 folks? Because it's getting really hard.
Yep.
Like, there's no, a lot of these inexpensive solutions are being squeezed.
Yeah. How hostile are they, Richard? How would you rate that?
Pretty hostile. Yeah. Right? Like pretty difficult.
I was in the Everglades. I asked the same thing about the alligators.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah,
they're not hostile until they want to eat you.
Yeah. All right, let's.
A crocodile's not hot. An alligator's not hostile. He's just busy. And you look and delicious.
He's hungry. He's busy. Yeah. You're delicious, and he runs faster than you do.
Did we get to the
last point.
Yeah.
So, and again, this is evolving, right? But if you look back over time, and I'll include next or 2 weeks from today, 2 weeks from yesterday in this list,
we have gotten
moment updates, right? These moments, right? So we're getting moment 3 in 2 weeks. We got moment 1 back in November, December. We got moment 2 in February, March. We're getting moment 3 in May, June. When would moment 4 fall? Well, September, October. Interesting. That's when they release a new version of Windows. So I think that 22, for all of, they may not do, mean this like technically or do this technically, but I think that 23H2 and moment 4 are the same thing. Essentially, they might be delivered in two different ways. Like there's a kind of an enablement package that puts you in 23H2, and then the moment 4 bits come through some CFR / whatever the other thing was called. I already forgot Windows. Configuration update or whatever it was. It doesn't really matter how they do it because, again, they have a million ways to do this. But I think this stuff all happens at roughly the same time. The nature of these updates means that sometimes you'll click on something in Windows Update and you'll get it. And sometimes you'll have to wait because it will come through a CFR and it's random and whatever. It doesn't really matter. The details aren't super important. But I think moment 4 / 23H2, I think those are the same thing. I think that's the same. It's the same milestone. And they're just making it vague. You know, it's like, we told you we were only going to release one feature update a year. We didn't tell you it was going to be nonsense and not amount to anything. We also didn't tell you we're going to have 117 features we're adding between now and then. But you know what? enjoy, because 23H2 for businesses will also be all of those other moments in CFRs that occurred after 22H2.
You know what I say? Features is features does.
That's right. CFRs are like a box of chocolates.
Exactly. No. That's even better. More apt.
Yeah, I was just looking
at these notes I took of Stevie Batiche, you know, and there's, you know, a couple pages of really juicy stuff. And then I went backwards to see what I took from Panos Panay.
Amazing.
Three lines.
That's amazing.
One of them is pumped.
You can literally, if you wrote those with your hand, you would see the line go across the page as you fell asleep.
Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure the Onyx runtime were the people between Panos and Stevie.
Yeah, you know what? So, yeah. I should really, let's tab that backwards because that isn't.
That's true. Right. That was a different person.
This is Panos. Yeah. Pumped. Right. What does it mean for us as people? That's it. Right there.
Yeah. 12 minutes.
12 minutes.
This is like the Dana Carvey impersonation of George H.W. Bush, where he's like,
I'm pumped.
1,000 points of light. It's like, still two minutes, Mr. President. 1,000 points of light. Didn't have anything to say. It's like, people like it when I say pumped. I'm going to say pumped a lot.
Pumped. Well, he got it in right away, and that was good. We didn't have to wait too long. Let's take a little break, and we will continue lots more to talk about. Windows Weekly is on the air with Rich Campbell and Paul Thurrott. Rich, you're back in Coquitlam, right? You're back at the house.
Yeah, I'm home for a couple, 3 weeks now.
So. Then back on the road? Man, you travel.
One more run to Kansas City for the KCDC conference, and then I'm going to try and spend a few weeks on the coast finishing this dang book. And so we've got a couple of juvenile sea lions hanging around right now, so you'll hear them in the recordings.
Cool.
Oh yeah, it's cool for you. You've never seen poop till you've seen 1,000 pounds of sea lion.
Oh boy. we have peacocks. They're just as noisy, but they're not as poopy.
So. Yeah, no, that's a lot of animal.
That is a lot of animal. Wow. Okay, well, there you go. Something to look forward to. Meanwhile, let me talk about our sponsor, ACI Learning. You know the name IT Pro, our trusted sponsor for the last decade. That kind of blows my mind. Yeah, they opened in 2013. IT Pro has always provided engaging, entertaining IT training. I know many of you are IT Pro. I want to say customers, it's not really customers, members. You're in the community. Now that IT Pro is part of the ACI Learning family, their capabilities impressively grow, along with their highly entertaining, bingeable, short format content, over 7,000 hours now and counting to choose from. That by itself shows you what the merger has meant. That's more than 1,000 new hours since the last time we talked. One of the things that really... one of the stats, I talk to these guys all the time. One of the stats that they gave us the other day that I thought was really interesting, about 30% of ACI learners are MSPs, managed service providers, people like our beloved Russell. People who do IT for other companies, you know, not as employees, but on contract. You're an MSP. You should know ACI Learning is dedicated to supporting your team through any challenge. You know, if you run an MSP, you know the most important thing is keeping your team engaged, informed, and up to date. And that's one of the reasons MSPs love ACI Learning. Oh, they love the practice labs, by the way, where you can test and experiment before deploying new apps or updates without touching your live system. You can do it all in virtual machine labs with multiple instances of whatever you need, Windows Server, desktop clients, and you can run it on anything, including a Chromebook. It's OS X, Linux, iOS, Windows platforms, anything with an HTML5 browser. But you're doing the real deal, you know, so you can really see, well, how is this configuration going to change our customer's experience? You can also keep your team up to date for challenging certification exams with the practice tests. You could take even retake tests before you take the real deal to make sure you're ready to sit for the exam. One MSP team leader said, quote, and this is a direct quote, I had 110 engineers in the field, and we had dozens of IT Pro accounts. Last year alone, they passed over 40 certs. That's huge. If your IT training isn't raising your team to the level you aspire, whether you're an MSP, an enterprise, you need ACI Learning. With the training industry's completion rate on their videos, really, it's surprisingly low. It's about 30%. Most people, more than most people, don't even finish those. It's a very, very different picture with ACI Learning's videos, about 80% completion rate. What does that tell you? That they're compelling, they're entertaining, and most importantly, people are learning from them. Because, you know, it's you don't watch something just because it's fun. When you're watching these kinds of training, you want to learn. You want to come away with it going, yeah, I am better than before. Don't settle for subpar training. This is the format IT pros and their teams want. You have a complete learning portal, the Pro Portal, which lets you assign courses, even little bits of courses. And by the way, all the videos have full transcripts, so you could say, I need them to learn this 13-minute segment right here. You can manage seats. You can see monthly usage reports, logins, and so forth, viewing time, courses viewed, tracks completed. That's very helpful to understand how your team's using it, but also to justify the spend at the hires up. You even get a very visuals report, so you can, you know, say, here's the graph or whatever. You'll stay compliant. That's really important these days. You can identify potential risks, equally important, and weaknesses before they become problematic. Future-proof your business. Retain top talent, because this is a great benefit. Upskill your team. Gain essential insights with training for individuals, teams, and leaders. And by the way, you'll be glad to know ACI Learning, unlike many other facilities, is ISO certified. So you know you're receiving world-class training, the best for your team. And don't they deserve the best? ACI Learning's, by the way, the best doesn't have to cost more. It's very affordable. ACI Learning's course is easy to navigate. Their structure is much more straightforward than traditional training programs. Look, I think the best thing to do, try it for yourself. And then you know, you'll get an idea. Then bring the team along. For individuals, we got a great discount, 30% off. Just use the offer code TWIT30, 30% off. That's either a standard or premium individual IT Pro membership. But if you want to learn about all that ACI Learning offers across audit, IT, and cybersecurity readiness, just go to the website. And please use this address so they know you saw it here, go.acilearning.com/twit, go.acilearning.com/twit. For any size team, from 2 people to 1,000 people, volume discounts start at 5 seats. Fill out the form at go.acilearning.com/twit. For more information on a free 2-week training trial for your team. Thank you, ACI Learning. They sponsor our studio. They sponsor Windows Weekly, many of our other shows. We appreciate their support. And you support us back by going to that address so they know you saw it here. go.acilearning.com/twit. Okay, let's see. Going back to the Notion. Windows 11 time. Paul and Richard.
I inserted an image there.
That's, it's beautiful.
The real source of the Windows 11 Bloom imagery.
That's a Kleenex box with all of the beautiful paper bloom coming out.
I thought it was all about the tears, but okay.
Well, that, the tears make it blue. That's what's, you know, it's a combination.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Very pretty. All right. What's new with Windows 11?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the week since Build kicked off, there hasn't been a lot of new news, right? I mean, yeah. Build was kind of the big thing. There's some discussion around when we're going to see features, right? Some of the stuff that Microsoft showed off at the show is happening in Moment 3, so it's in about 2 weeks. Some of it's coming in what I think of as Moment 4/23H2, right? So Copilot, obviously, is one of those features. But will be available through the Windows Insider program starting next month as we record this in June. But since we talked last, there has been new builds across Canary, Dev, and Beta. The Canary and Beta builds are fairly minor, but if you want to get started on some of the stuff they showed off and some of the stuff we just talked about, like Dev Drive and Windows Backup, that's actually available now in the Dev channel, which is pretty good. And a feature that a lot of people have asked for in the taskbar, which is bringing back that combine, never combine option that we always had before for the icons in the taskbar. Not the ability to move it to the top of the screen. Don't ask.
I wasn't going to say anything. Not saying. I'm genuinely holding out for an ARM laptop. I think now I'm going to, I think I'm going to pave this book two down to a pure M365 config. Okay. And hold out for an ARM.
Why?
Because I think it's only months away, and And let's face, I spent a little time with one of the new MacBook Airs.
Mm-hmm. Aren't they great?
It's the best computer on the planet.
And it runs, ironically, with Parallels, runs Windows on ARM pretty well.
Pretty well, yeah.
Let me assist on that sentence. It runs it better, which is a huge problem.
It's so depressing.
A huge problem.
But this happened before, right? This is how the whole P4 architecture got abandoned, right? When the Israelis made the P3 multi-core outran the best P4 and it cost a quarter. That was like, oh, gee, I guess we're going core duo.
It was more dramatic than that because Intel had gone all in on Itanium, right?
That's earlier. But
they said, holy,
that was going to be the chipset of the future.
Holy crap, this architecture doesn't work. And it was a lucky thing that that skunk works in Israel.
That's right.
Yeah. They were working on mobile chipsets, right?
Like, it was a 1-2 punch of embarrassment there, because the other thing that happened around that same time was they were kind of forced to adopt the AMD, the AMD X64 stuff.
Yeah.
Which 64-bit Windows is something that came up out of AMD.
Yeah, because Cutler put out Windows on Windows as support for that. And that was also when they had been misled by the folks that made the serial RAM, SRAM, and they were that's that same year. You're going to talk about how messed up Intel is today.
Was that RAM bus?
That's RAM bus. Yeah. RAM bus going to the open meetings for RAM architecture and then writing patents against the open meeting. Those guys. Remember those guys?
And remember, we thought, man, this is going to change everything.
Oh, yeah. I built one SRAM machine. It didn't work at all. And then they made a retro kit to convert it to regular DRAM. And talk about a bad sideline.
You know, it's funny. That would be a good book, is Dead Ends. You know, Tech Dead Ends.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes.
Places, companies said, this is the next, because I think we're, by the way, just between you and me, Apple's about to head down a very long cul-de-sac with, I think, VR. right? And maybe. This would be
see if they don't pull back.
They're not going to pull back. They have too much invested.
No, this is happening.
I also run into the same thing with GPT-4, right?
Like, I agree. I
mean, this could, the alternative to this is not that it takes over the world. It's that it's too expensive to operate and it gets shut down. This could be the 3D TV.
This would be a good time to start that book. And leave a hole for two last chapters.
Right. Yeah. Well, because either individual hardware makers or people that are companies that used to not be hardware makers like Microsoft that are rushing to make their own hardware will either get this right and lower the cost, or we're just all gonna, or Nvidia becomes the biggest company in the world. You know,
they are sure ballooning up. The question is it hot air?
Join it right now.
Hey, a trillion dollars is a trillion dollars.
It adds up.
A trillion here, a trillion there. Pretty soon you're talking real money.
Real money. It isn't real money, Paul. That's the problem.
No,
real money unless you decide to, liquidate. And you better do it
Chris
fast.
Cap thing, market cap floats all boats.
Yeah, I guess. You know? Does it? Is that what he says?
I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I guess, yeah. We've seen companies, though, with inflated market caps that have last time I checked, Nvidia was 200, the price to earnings was 200 times, I think. It's probably bigger now.
Yeah, but you know what?
It's Amazon like numbers, man.
We've never had a bubble, so I'm not really worried about anything.
Bubbles aren't a thing.
I'm telling you, what a good book. You guys got to write this book called The Dead Ends I Have Known and Loved.
Technological cul-de-sacs.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's the Stephen Wright joke. It's a one-way dead-end street. I don't know how I got there, but now I can't leave.
And Waymo can be one of them, because those Waymo cars in San Francisco, they keep going down that dead end. There's a dead-end street because the strict rules are, I guess, you can't turn left at one point. So the only way, if you're going to follow the rules, is to go down a dead-end street, make a U-turn, and come out and make a right turn. And so, normal drivers go, well, screw that, I'm turning left here. But the Waymos, they all go down that street. And the neighbors are bitching because I'm sure they fixed it by now.
Well, you know what would be worse is if they went in reverse. And then they could be like, beep, 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 beep.
Well, they probably do because I don't think they can do a full U-turn. So I bet you that's one of the problems is they do a Y U-turn. And so you get the intermittent beep, beep.
Yeah, it's like, look at this guy. He's doing like a 21-point turn for some reason. Beep, beep.
Unbelievable.
Another good one. Literal dead ends. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, literal dead ends.
Literal dead ends. So,
as opposed to figurative dead ends, right. Although apparently it means the same thing.
Ends up the same way.
Language is nothing.
Yeah.
God. Anyway, I'm sorry.
So
I did an episode of Hands on Windows the other day that will come out in the future. I don't remember about moment three. And I was the third feature I highlighted was adding seconds to the clock. And I said, in case you were wondering if this was a big update or not, we're already on seconds. So sorry. You know,
that's hysterical. I think we made that one public. I can't remember it. I think that one is on the YouTube channel. So that I should mention what that is. Paul does a weekly show called Hands on Windows. Micah does Hands on Macintosh. We have lots of other shows. They're club only. And then we'll take one that, you know, has a universal interest. We'll put it out on YouTube as a, you know, kind of like a tease. You want more?
Sure.
You want more, buddy? You know where to go. twit.tv/clubtwit. $7 a month. I'll put in a quick plug. $7 a month. Ad-free versions of all the shows. Access to the Discord. Access to special shows. We launch shows in the club. Hands on Windows, Hands on Macintosh, Scott Wilkinson's Homes Theater Geeks. That's where This Week in Space came from. It was launched out of the club, thanks to the club members. So it's a great way to support us as advertising dollars dwindle, and it is podcast-wide, they're dwindling. We really realize that the subscription model is going to be – I don't want to ever have a paywall. I don't like that idea. But,
you know, the way to look at this is, I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but if you look at Spotify, which has both paid and non-paying customers, the paid customers are a small percentage of the non-paying, but they
support everybody else.
They generate 95% of the revenues, you know, so it's kind of a nice system, from that perspective. And it's good for people.
I'm happy for that.
Can pay to have, a nice ad-free experience.
And we want to offer, you know, our content free to everybody because it's democratic, you know? So if we can do this, the best of both worlds.
Off of the choice. Yeah, exactly.
Even if advertising kind of just goes away, I think we would always have free content, but we just encourage people to subscribe. Right now, it's a little more than 1% of the audience subscribes. It's, you know, if we get it to 5%, we'd be able to continue on forever.
Great.
Yeah. And I want to continue on forever because I will never die. Now,
all right.
We will eventually down, there will be digital Elon.
Digital Leo. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, you can't spell Elon without Leo.
That's a good point. I don't know.
Just saying.
I don't know. Let's see. So there were there were preview builds last week. Did you?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I just went through that. So nothing major there. But
moment three next week. Okay.
Yeah. Moment three next week. Just remind. Not next week. Sorry. In.
Week D.
13 days. You
know, week D.
Week B. Sorry.
B.
Of June, because we're moving into June.
Oh, we're going. Good Lord. It's the end of May. I forgot. Oh, yeah. God. It's going to be June. Holy cow.
Yep.
I loved this story.
I know. I did, too.
Here's the Windows you've always wanted, but could never activate.
You know what? Every version of Windows is the version no one wants until it's the version they can't stand to give up. You know, Windows XP, people kind of forget this. It debuted to not necessarily hugely positive reviews.
It was Windows 2000 with the Fisher-Price interface.
Exactly. A sea of blues and greens, I called it, causing me to lose a friend at Microsoft who designed it. And and was in the market forever, right? And then it became like, oh, I don't want to go to Windows Vista. You know, everyone loved it all of a sudden again. But I went through this process myself of installing Windows XP a couple of years ago because I was writing the book, right? I wanted to go back and install old versions of OSs, put old versions of Visual Studio on top of it, old versions of Office. I did all that stuff. So there have been lots of cracks for Windows XP activation. And I think I probably have a silly number of keys for this, actually. But there have been different cracks over the years. Microsoft took their activation service offline, right? So what this crack does is it lets you do it offline. So
interesting.
Yeah, it just works and it works and it generates exactly the same key for a PC every time. So if you run it on that against that PC, you'll get the identical key every time and it'll always activate. So it's kind of an interesting thing. So they're done with that. Like XP has been done. And I'll just tell you I probably told the story before because it's Windows Weekly, but at the in June of that year, so June 2001, we went to New York for the reviewers workshop. There was a beta one back in Seattle in that February, and then in the summer they had the main reviewers workshop. That's when they introduced activation. They didn't say anything about it until June, And no one wanted to talk to anyone at that show except for that guy, the one guy who was there for activation. And so there was all these product tables and teams around, completely empty room, and one giant line waiting to talk to this one guy. It was like that scene in the Airplane movie where everyone's standing with like a pipe and they're waiting to smack that woman around or whatever.
Yeah.
Like everyone on the plane is in line to get their turn. That was that guy. And he was so beaten up by the end of the show. It was him and Joe Belfiore and a couple of other guys. And they were like, we want to go out and get, and I took them to Little Italy, and we went to an Italian restaurant called Luna's. Luna, of course, was the code name for the Windows XP Sea of Blue and Green UI. So right. It kind of worked out nicely for him. But man, did that guy need to drink that yeah. day. So anyway, here we are. What is it? 22 years later? Finally yep. cracked.
Completely cracked. Yeah.
Yep.
They figured it out.
Poor bastard. I don't even remember his name.
I bet it installed really quickly too.
Yeah. That's the thing about these old OSs. It's a nostalgic walk through the park, of course, but there's not a lot there compared to what we have today, right?
I bet it doesn't understand HD. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem. Like,
yeah. Lots of security vulnerabilities in this thing right off the bat too. I remember it being in the audience at the launch, and there were like 100 Wi-Fi networks you could connect to, and all of them were wide open because we didn't know what we were doing, you know?
No.
And then there was the, universal plug and play thing that happened over the holidays that year. And Jim Alchin infamously was on vacation with his family, got the phone call, and he's like, well, you guys enjoy the rest of your vacation. I'm flying home, you mm-hmm. know?
But they didn't get USB in until after Service Pack 2.
Yeah, I don't remember. UPnP. I mean, this is the universal.
Oh, universal plug and play as opposed to.
Yeah, this is the thing serialist. That kicked off trustworthy computing, right? It was, they released this piece of junk out into the world. It was completely mm-hmm. open and unprotected. And they were like, we got to get on top of this. And so they halted over time.
They already knew that.
All new development.
But they already knew that before they shipped, right? Because the trustworthy computing letter came out at the beginning of 2001, and they shipped XP at the end of 2001.
Exact timing, but
so an SP an SP1 was already all the stuff they'd shoved out to get delivered. So that's why the SP2 team was formed and stripped a lot of senior guys out of Windows to be able to re-engineer the kernel.
Right, because service packs back then were created by a different team at Microsoft than the main Windows team. They were it was sent into basically a servicing stack, and it was not the main Windows team was going to go off and work on the next version.
Mm-hmm. And for this not release, for SP2.
They had to change it.
And one would argue that was part of the problems that led to Vista was that those guys were head down for 3 years trying to make SP2 work.
That's part of the reason it was delayed. That's right.
Yeah. And so was Alchin. Alchin worked on SP2. He didn't, it was Valentine that was leading Blackcomb.
That's right.
Before Alchin finished SP2 and then it became Longhorn.
Blackcomb and then Whistler, right? Where was Whistler?
Well, Whistler was XP.
XP.
Okay.
And then Blackcomb is the next mountain over. And between the two mountains is a great big bar called the Longhorn Bar.
It's a million years ago, but I was the person that broke the Whistler codename and the person who broke the Longhorn codename.
So great. I love that.
Skied them both and got drunk in the middle.
They definitely got drunk in the middle.
Yeah. And so did Gates, right? Like they were famous for that was the SLT used to go to Whistler.
Really? Well, that's when he became the chief software. What do you call him? Chief architect, whatever he was. Yeah. But yeah, he was all about database backed file systems. And
yeah, he was a big believer in that. And there's an apocryphal story of the drive up to Whistler on the 99 mm-hmm. and Gates and a bunch of the guys breaking down on the side of the road north of Squamish.
Yeah.
And an old guy coming down in a pickup truck and fixing their car on the spot for them so they continue on. And Gates wanted to give him a thank you gift and basically got his name, found his mortgage and paid it.
Wow.
Nice.
Wow.
I would have left that guy. I would have done that joke where I pull over and say, you guys need a ride. Then they come to the car and I peel out and leave them in the dust. You know?
It's like, it's been all downhill since Millennium Edition.
Right. Oh, you guys did Windows Me? Hold on 1 second. Puts the car in reverse.
I got to go.
They kind of did that with a da 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 parody. Ad.
Yeah.
They left left the stinky, the
smelly Sun Microsystems box station.
Oh, man.
Yesterday, Steve Gibson said HP stands for huge pile.
They're still my favorite computers.
Actually, you know what? Once the PC division spun off from HPE, I think they make really nice PCs.
I think it was a couple of episodes ago I complained about earnings and how it actually, you think it's all going to happen in the same week or two, but it's actually kind of spread out. Yeah. These companies reported different things. So
yeah, they have a different quarter, right?
Yeah, their quarter ended on April 30th. Like, seriously, guys, it's not a clown car. Let's, can we just line up, you know?
Just because anyway. It's inconvenient for you.
I know. Well, just like to get it out of the way. It's like going to the dentist. Can I do all my teeth at once? You know? Anywho, as with the rest of the industry, obviously, things aren't going great over there. Most of their revenues come from PCs. PC business revenues fell 29% in the quarter. Consumer PCs fell 39%. Commercials down 24%. Total units sold were down 28%, which is kind of in line with the estimates from IDC.
These are comparables, which, right? Yeah, like, absolutely comparables. I'm sad that the printer business isn't down more because printers.
I literally declined to write much about that because I just
think, you know what? This is a whole other article.
That's right.
How printers make me angry.
Yep. It's like they're adding DRM to ink now or something. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Truly.
Yep.
That's why I call them huge pile, by the way, because. Oh, no. Yeah.
Oh, it wasn't that.
Although that's a good reason. It was also the fact that they pushed out an update that bricked their printers because they were trying to update the DRM on the printer ink.
Right. We're trying to screw our customers. In the process, we screwed our customers.
We really screwed them.
I mean, the first one was on purpose, so that would have been fine.
But this accidental one, we're really sorry about that.
That was a mistake. Anyway, I hope this is the last one I do for a while, but... No, what am I talking about? Yeah, I got 30 days until the end of this actual quarter, so we'll be doing this again soon. We'll see how things go. A lot of people expect the second half of this year to be better. HP sort of said the same thing, although the second half of HP's year is what? I think there was the second or third quarter. I don't remember. The next two quarters. Doesn't matter. It doesn't line up exactly. Should be more positive, but year-over-year comparisons will still be negative. So they're hoping it's not going to be as bad, I guess, is maybe the way to look at it. We'll see.
Man.
We'll see what happens. There's that. And I haven't written about this. I've got two things in the notes that I did not write about yet, and I may not. But the Wall Street Journal has a very interesting interview with Pat Gelsinger, speaking of Intel. And he, I have to say, has been pretty open and honest, as much as we can tell, about what's going wrong there. He talked about the culture at the company before and how it was a disaster and, and his current strategy, which is to kind of turn Intel into a foundry business, right, where they're going to make the chips. And this is kind of what differentiates Intel from its competitors. I got to tell you, this is maybe not a great comparison, but
They want to be TSMC? Is that where they're...
Yeah, well, they want to be another TMSC, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah,
right? So
TSMC. You really like to put a TMSC. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company.
Yeah. When you say it like that, it makes sense. So this reminds me of Nokia, right? If you had gone to Nokia a couple of years before they were sold to Microsoft, most of it was sold to Microsoft, and you said, what are your big strengths? I think one of the things they might have said was we do the whole thing. We do everything.
Yeah.
They had places, factories and facilities all over the planet, tons and tons of employees, all of them with expensive health insurance plans and retirement plans and whatever else. And honestly, there was just a lot of overhead there. Commodore actually had the same problem a million years ago.
But they also believed they could build an operating system, right? We do these things not because they're easy, but because we think they're easy. And Symbian was bad.
Like, it was bad. Yeah, no,
that, but it's that, also just that. Fundamentally did not understand, and neither did RIM, by the way. Like, just because you make hardware, it's like you almost have this disease. You think software is easy. Building good operating systems,
by the way,
is
that
flipping
disease,
hard.
That disease goes both ways. It's like mad cow.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, yeah. The software people are like, you just make hardware. Just make the hardware. It's
how hard could it be? We'll make hardware that works well with our software.
Yeah. Are you saying the brain blood barrier is permeable?
Is exactly like hardware software. Yeah, I did make that comparison.
I'm going to go on record saying I liked Symbian on the Scion 3A. That was just right. But it was right size.
So wait. Was that with those little brain things? Are they Scions or Prions?
Prions. Prions.
They're Prions.
Yeah. You're talking about mad cow disease. Yeah.
Yep. So I
wow, listen, this is a wide like ranging conversation. I just want to say no, I love it.
Drugs were taken before the recording. No,
we're like this normally.
This is just a little punchy on Wednesday afternoon.
I love it.
So I would like Intel to succeed. I really would. I don't know. You know,
it doesn't look good.
It's a weird thing to say because in this industry, they're still at the top, you know, but mm-hmm. I feel like there's a big chunk of losses to come that's going to come from servers and cloud computing that they're just not going to be part of that wave. And I think when that falls apart, if that falls apart for them, if that part of the market goes to AMD or ARM, which is more likely, I don't know how you recover from that. So we'll see.
Yeah, I think AMD will continue to make the compatible chips for the old architecture, for the x86, x64. And ARM is beginning to dominate.
Right.
Now, we're just getting such good results.
We should say that Intel has announced, and they talked about it at Build, the Meteor Lake, which will have not an NPU.
I know. God damn them.
But a VPU.
Seriously, a VPU. And what does that stand for, Leo?
Visual Processing Unit.
Yeah. Actually, oddly, I've seen two definitions of it. I've seen two different terms. I'm trying to remember what the other one was. But yeah, we'll call it visual.
I think that's what Intel's saying. It's a visual processing.
Okay.
And of course, NPU is Neural Processing Unit, which is a general purpose.
No, what I meant is that the V and VPU, I've seen it written two different terms.
I think Intel said visual, but I might be wrong. But anyway.
Let's just go with victory because that's all they're looking for now.
And you
right?
can see the problem. The entire industry, even at Build, Microsoft, NPU, so, and Intel, which has an NPU in Meteor Lake, but they've chosen to call it a VPU.
Well, if it helps, and I know it doesn't. Qualcomm doesn't call it that either. Right?
What do they call it?
Apparently, NPU is
Apple owns it or something, or?
No,
is it ARM?
They told me that NPU is a Microsoft term, by the way. I think NPU is sort of the
Apple
right term.
Apple calls it an NPU, I think.
No, they call it a neural engine.
You're right. Okay.
So
maybe Microsoft owns NPU.
I think we're getting a little crazy with the brands here. I think we should just admit that these things are all the same thing. But from Qualcomm's perspective, they have something called an AI engine, which is not that chip. It is the combination of it's everything on the SoC. So it's what we would call the CPU, the GPU, plus what we're calling an NPU. They say together, this thing is an AI engine and they work hand in hand and yada, you know, like the die on an A series processor, like when you see at Apple.
I'm trying to think who's got enough cloud. The same way that Cutler forced Intel to the table on the X64 extensions, like who's got the clout in our industry to say, hey, it should be an NPU, and it should more or less look like this. It's probably NVIDIA.
Oh, there you go. I was just going to say, Microsoft absolutely does not.
Right. But if NVIDIA decided to say, here's an open specification, we're going to build to this, you guys feel free, we're calling the neural processing unit going forward, I just don't see they have any reason to do that.
That's an interesting point, because NVIDIA's offerings, if I'm not mistaken, aren't they, I don't mean to say just, but aren't they GPUs, essentially?
They're CUDA, which was originally a GPU, but it's almost simplified. They've taken a bunch of the other stuff off.
What do they call these chips?
They're all codenamed.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's basically where they're going. And they don't have to talk much because they essentially have two customers. Right.
Like, right. That's right.
For the most part, everything
really
they're making
big customers.
Everything they're making is going to Microsoft and Amazon right now. Like that's sort of the reality. And, you know, I've got a show coming with Racinovich. We didn't really talk about this online, but offline it was like, oh, no, we're buying quarters worth of production.
Yeah. That's why they're working so fast to try to come up with their own chipsets, because that stuff is expensive.
Well, and it's also, you know, there is optimization to be had. Like for what it takes to run GPT-4, why wouldn't you make dedicated hardware for this?
It's a good point.
Right. But one would argue, in general, what you're really talking about is generative processors designed to do generative models.
Who made
models?
The Voodoo cards? The 3DFX.
3DFX,
exactly. Yeah. So they used to, at one point, sold a card that was just for Quake. That was the whole point of it.
Wow. Yeah.
You buy this thing, you
that's
play
how,
Quake on it.
That's really more a statement about how big Quake was back in the day than anything else.
Well, but I mean,
wow.
Or at the point where you do the same thing for AI, I mean.
Yeah. Well, but see, that's the virtue of what Apple's doing is, so you describe, I think it was you who described this last week, that there's CPU, GPU, and NPU, we'll call it NPU. The NPU is not as fast as a GPU, right? Richard, maybe.
No, I don't remember that conversation.
Maybe,
but
Richard, it was Richard.
It's just optimized for these particular workloads.
It's the same kind of thing, though, because it's what it is.
Well, right. I mean,
processing a chunk of data, right?
It's not, so yeah. You go back to like Windows, Longhorn at the time, right? And Longhorn, one of the big deals was we're going to have hardware accelerated graphics. Mm-hmm. Now, to do hardware accelerated graphics at the time, this became not true later on, but at the time, you literally needed a dedicated GPU. So the natural reaction is, well, hold on a second. You're telling me that I'm going to put a dedicated GPU into a laptop in this case, and this thing is going to run that UI more efficiently, and that somehow the combination of these things will make the system more efficient overall? Because it seems to me that adding a GPU to a system will make it less efficient. But you take workloads, for lack of a better term, because I'm not a hardware guy, but you take workloads off of the CPU, and that actually does a lot to help that thing run more efficiently, because now mm-hmm. the CPU is not running gangbusters the whole time to get everything done. And I think the NPU is, you know, again, I'm super high level here, but I think it's kind of the same thing. It's more, way more efficient than a CPU and more efficient than a GPU for those.
Yeah. I think the GPU and the NPU have a lot more, they're both scalar processors. Like the math is simple, but
exactly.
We do a lot of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
They do block operations, right?
Yeah.
It goes back to the, what was it? The MMS or processing on the
Multimedia extensions.
Yeah.
The MMX.
X. That's it.
MX, yeah.
On the Intel processors. The same thing. You were processing
they had
large
macro processors back in the day too, right?
Yeah, but that was
the
that
had
was
special
different.
Chips for
math co-processors were so you could do floating point, and so they could have the radix and the prefix or whatever it was separate mm-hmm. registers. But right. I honestly think a GPU and NPU are close, but an NPU is
pretty
slower.
Similar.
But it's slower, right?
Hmm. Not necessarily. I mean, it depends.
It's not about clock speed
iterations
on an NPU,
right?
Well, it still is because you are adjusting values quickly.
Yeah, yeah. You want to process this quickly.
Yeah, but it's running very parallel. And
parallel is the key, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
So there's a session at Build, which is Mark Rizinovich and I just lost his name. And someone else? Jesus, I'm losing it.
The closing session with Hanselman?
No, it was the Hanselman. Sorry, thank you. Scott Hanselman.
Yeah.
And it was like, let's code with Mark and Scott kind of thing, right? And they make a JavaScript-based Asteroids game, multiplayer, whatever it is. Doesn't matter. The whole point of this thing isn't to make the JavaScript game, which is stupid. It's really for that part in the middle where Mark explains how these NPUs work. And I had the same experience watching this I did when I learned about quantum computing, which is like, I'm sure what you're saying makes total sense. I'm an idiot. I have no idea what you're talking about. He explained it, you know, as clearly as one could, I think. It's complicated. I mean, it's just, it's...
These guys are big brains. I mean, we're humble mortals. They are in another world.
And, no, as far as I'm concerned, they're up in the heavens bowling, and that's what thunder is. Like, I don't know.
Thunder. It's thunder. Yeah. So you could use, in fact, do use, maybe Richard would explain this to me. You could use GPUs to do those kinds of loads. In fact, that's kind of what NVIDIA does with their TPUs.
And they absolutely do.
Yeah.
But there's a significant similarity between a ray tracing problem for graphics and a generative backpropagation problem in machine learning. Like they're very similar. They're propagating values across multiple nodes.
Okay. Now I'm also looking at an explainer that says that NPUs are optimized for matrix multiplication. Which is interesting.
Yes. Well, so and that's the same thing. A ray trace is a matrix multiplication.
Yeah.
And a transform is a ray a matrix multiplier.
So they are related.
This is a glorified tip calculator is what I'm hearing.
You just look at, here's what I do. Double the amount and move the decimal point over. That's another matter. Another day.
Yeah.
I have a TPU in my brain, a tip processing unit. Yeah.
Sure.
So GPU is too general purpose to be efficient for AI workloads. So Google, maybe it was a Google I/O description. So, but this is why Google, the CPU architecture is based on the von Neumann architecture.
Right.
Every calculation of the CPU is stored in L1 cache memory. And so you get a, Google, you get a pipeline.
Are you talking about data center trips, chips or chips for the
all device? Chips. This is all true of all chips. All chips. Okay. So that was von Neumann's insight, was you can create kind of like a pipeline, a assembly line that would and you'd have memory, you'd have a CPU, and you'd have storage. The ALU, arithmetic logic units, a circuit that controls memory access, executes each. Well, this might be too complicated for the show, but I'm looking at an interesting article about this.
I like that. I'm probably the limiter on this one, not the audience.
It's I don't want to hurt Paul's brain, so I'll save this for some other time. No, this is a. I'll put a link somewhere in this article. I was just doing, I did a search and I found AI chips, GPU, TPU, and NPU.
Interesting.
This is it.
Well, yeah, there was a little diagram similar to this at the build session.
I feel like I saw this on one of the keynotes recently.
And I knew I was in trouble. And he explained the math and I was like, oh man, I'm not going to walk away.
Not to be outdone, Microsoft has designed their own AI architecture based on field programmable gate arrays, FPGAs. They call their hardware the Neural Processing Unit, NPU, and it powers Azure and Bing. Right. They scaled the FPGA architecture for deep learning workloads. That's Project Brainwave.
Yeah, so they point out that Microsoft came up with this name. That's what Qualcomm told me as well.
So that's why nobody uses it. I get it now. Yeah.
Yeah. I just think it's a good term. I didn't know Microsoft came up with this. I think this is a good term for it.
Yeah. Unfortunately. Encumbered, as we say.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It is an encumbered
patent. We talk about Microsoft breaking Surface.
Speaking of bricking the hardware, it's not HP alone.
Boy.
Whoops. They fixed it now, though. No?
Sort of. Oh. Not exactly.
Okay. What happened?
So the seven people that own the other Surface story. The seven people that own a Surface Pro X woke up one day and found their camera wasn't working anymore.
Nice.
There's lots of theories about why that might have happened. So Microsoft put out a temporary workaround that you can use the integrated camera on. And it doesn't completely work. I mean, I guess the quality of the camera is lower now when using this workaround. I can't even imagine how that's possible, but maybe it turns off all the AI stuff. Cause remember, Windows and ARM devices are the only ones that can access today, Windows Studio Effects, which are those AI background blur, camera tracking, et cetera, features. So anyway, there will be a fix, a driver update that will fix this, that will come out as soon as possible, obviously. But in the meantime, you can use an external camera. You could have really crappy quality on the built-in camera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so someone in Discord has pointed out the other Surface story, which I meant to add to the notes and forgot.
Yeah.
Which was that Microsoft issued a security patch. And now these devices are randomly rebooting.
I mean, the Surface Duo is randomly rebooting, including the Duo 2 and Duo 1.
Yeah.
Spent $2,000 on a folding phone just to have it reboot randomly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not great.
I'm disappointed because I really had high hopes, as you know, for the Duo.
It was so cute. Panasonic is all about quality and reliability. So
don't worry. And wandering in crowds.
And was right like a homeless person.
That was like, really weird.
When have you seen my keynote around here? I used to have a keynote.
Doors, you know. All I could imagine was like you're in the audience, you're anonymous. You could be snoozing, you're watching a video or something, and you're like, "Is that guy walking toward me?
He's coming this way.
Am I going to be on the video now? Like, do I have to pay attention?"
I don't understand why no imp of the perverse jumped up and didn't tackle him. You know, like how do you resist that moment?
But look back at the video, there were people stoically sitting facing straight ahead as Panos went by. I am not going to look. Not going to look.
Like a homeless person's ranting in the aisle.
Do not make eye contact.
Just give him a dollar. He doesn't have to clean the windshield. Just keep moving.
Don't look at the VP. Looking at VPs is a mistake. Don't look.
It's kind of funny because that's exactly what's going on in their mind. It's like,
I know. No, you can see it. It's the total deer in the headlight thing. And I don't know. One time he took we were in an audience. He took my laptop out of my hands. I was typing on it. And then he used it as some kind of example, and he handed it back to me closed. It was like, thanks. I was kind of in the middle of using that. But
It's, you know, it's like a method actor who's so entranced with his own method that he thinks everyone else is just going to be equally entranced.
And everybody's entranced till they get pepper sprayed.
That's great.
It's like,
that's what I need for him.
This is so profound and deep that when I will take Paul's laptop and use it to make a point, close it and give it back to him. And you will be as equally enthralled by this move as I am. And the fact is, everybody's going
to, I was like, it's the flip, the bit flipped. And I was like, I don't like this guy.
Somebody at Microsoft does, obviously, right? I mean, the right thing to do would have been said, Panos, we took away all your content. Why don't we just skip this time?
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. Hey, you know what? 2 minutes at the top. I hope you're really excited about the announcements from yesterday.
You could have done that.
I really want to introduce you to my team. They've really kicked ass.
There you go.
And they have lots of good stuff to talk about. Like, you could have been a really great leader right there and there.
Yep.
And just moved along.
Well, great leaders.
They were going to go 20 over anyway, so you might as well take that 10 minutes. And
exactly. That was the thing. They were supposed to have breaks in there.
Wow.
Oh, well.
Okay.
Oh, well.
Okay. Let's take this sour taste out of our mouth.
Exactly.
Talk about Xbox.
And talk about Xbox.
Refreshing Xbox.
So it's time for the Spearmint Refreshment built into Xbox.
I read these notes from Marguerite.
Yeah. Did you? What do you think?
I really want your take, because I thought they were very that is a smart person.
Okay, I was going to say, because you're not
No,
you don't understand. Leo will remember this. I would leave my wife for this woman.
No, you
would. I
would. You're talking about Margareta Vestager, who is the competitions director or whatever for the EU.
I was really nervous you're going to go in a negative direction there, because I got to tell you, I love
her. No. I was blown away. It's the between the line stuff. Like, she is so elegantly telling everyone, telling the UK, well, you screwed this up so bad.
Oh, that's interesting.
And giving them an out, showing them the way out of
That's right. The two things that, well, I come into this.
I don't want to be sexist, but she is a handsome woman.
I'm telling you. I love her.
So smart. Holy man.
And she's fantastic.
But see, we've had complaints about Vestager as well. Haven't we?
Right. So you got the context here is the EU is kind of top heavy with bureaucracy.
Yes.
They're obviously are making a career out of going after big tech, all of which is from the United States. So you get that kind of competitive thing, which, you know, we don't like here. You know, we don't like to see that. But they are very quick to go after companies, very slow to finalize the process. So, you know, charges come and then 8 years goes by and nothing has happened. I mean, so there's that kind of weirdness. I can't put that on her shoulders, right? This was the case with her predecessors. It's not her. It's the
system
process. Yeah, it's a system. On the other hand, they approve this deal. And the EU has far greater concerns about possible competitive ramifications of gaming in general or any particular gaming market than does the UK. There's just way more companies in the EU. There are way more people. You know, this is the bigger thing. And this was almost I don't want to call it a masterclass, but I thought it was a very good example of giving someone an out. Mm-hmm. I had this person I worked with a million years ago. I'm almost afraid to say this out loud because there is a small chance he's listening. But you reach a point sometimes with people where you have to say, look, you're either an idiot or you're wrong. It's your choice. You tell me which one it is, and then we'll move forward, because nothing you say makes sense.
I can hear that.
You know, so
I just hear you saying that to somebody.
I mean, no, at some point you just stop. You're like, stop talking. You're not there. What that person needed and what people need when they're wrong is we all make mistakes moment. Like, they need look, you did the right thing.
Don't
you did the wrong thing for the right reason.
Don't double down now. Now
stop digging a hole.
Yeah. You need to be more political than I am. You know, like you need to give people that out.
Yeah.
And I feel like she, like Richard said, I feel like she did that. How do two smart people, or two, you know, smart groups of people, however you want to say it, look at the same problem and come away with completely different conclusions?
So she was speaking to this, I'm not going to pronounce this right.
It's very long.
The Studienvergungskartellrecht. Why don't they, you know, just speak English, okay? For all these European long words, weird words. Oh, come on, just, you know, speak the language as it's written.
I bet she nailed it, though, when she said it.
Oh, I'm sure she said it perfectly. Check Against Delivery is the title of her talk. on simplification, the effort to cut red tape. So what did she say? I mean, can you summarize?
You've got miles to go. This is very long.
That's a long piece.
You know, the brilliant part was saying, hey, we care about cloud gaming, but Activision doesn't. Activision never put any of their games into the cloud, but Microsoft says they will. This is actually going to make cloud gaming better.
Right. Well, she says, firstly, some people,
as in the
some the people, Brits, you know, those
think
people,
that agencies should either block or clear mergers. Nothing in between. Right. She says, that's not our policy. We cannot, as a matter of principle, dismiss remedy proposals.
By the way, that's not antitrust policy almost anywhere. The point is, well, you can say yes or no. I mean, obviously, that is one thing. But what you're looking for are, you see a deal of this size and you think, okay, look, Microsoft's going to have to make concessions. What might those concessions be? When everyone thought it was all about Call of Duty, they came out and said, look, we'll put Call of Duty everywhere for 10 years. We'll make an agreement with anyone. And did. They made agreements with everyone. The only company that didn't sign it that was offered it was Sony, which just doesn't want them to get the company.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. So
it is interesting, though, I have to say that, she's the lead on this in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
They've already signed off. They think it's a good to go.
Yeah. You said this last week, Paul, think the British did this as just up yours to Europe. Like, we're not Europe, see?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, great. No, you have shown that you're separate. You're the dumb part. And it's just, she says this very well. First of all, 80% of their conditional clearances relied on structural remedies, right? In other words, you can't just dismiss remedy proposals. That's the part where she gets as close as I think as she ever gets in this is to saying you screwed up. You have just dismissed the proposal. When Microsoft kind of says we offered them this, they just didn't, it doesn't appear anywhere in the CMA documentation. They just said, no, we're not doing it because of this thing.
Yeah. Which is not a thing.
Right. So it's at Microsoft. This is not in her letter, but Microsoft has since come out and kind of said, the UK looked at this cloud gaming as if it were some kind of a market. They're like, Microsoft dominates the market for cloud gaming. First of all, if that were a market, it's the tiniest market in the world. It's nothing, but whatever. They're like, cloud gaming is not a market. It's a delivery system.
Yeah.
So if you're saying we dominate a world in which games are delivered in this fashion, okay. But most games are not delivered like that. Like 99% of games are not delivered in that fashion. So calling us dominant in this little area is one of those, what's the term? When something's technically true, but it's completely irrelevant, it's just, that's all that is. And that's, that's a great way of putting it.
It's a straw man.
Yep. Crazy.
But if I'm the UK regulator, I'm saying, thank you, Marguerite. This is exactly why we have Brexit. So you can't tell us what to do.
Right.
She has no. She has no standing.
I love that we're all being victimized by this attitude problem. And by the way, listen, we get that you want to be separate. One thing you could do is communicate with each other. did the UK have anything to offer to the EU that might have changed their minds? Apparently not. Right. Yeah. And what about the reverse? I don't think they were listening.
Yeah,
anyway, I thought this was an interesting turnout.
I'm surprised she came out and did this because she didn't need to. They'd already approved it. I don't know that it gives any option or not.
I'm not saying I have no knowledge of this. Why would I? But I have to wonder if this isn't a response to the fact that when the EU announced that they had cleared this thing conditionally, the UK CMA felt the need to go into to unleash a tweet storm defending their decision.
Right.
just shut up. You don't have to reply.
Nope.
They're not in your jurisdiction. Nobody cares what you think about it. But it just came off as petulant.
Yeah.
So now she responds to that and she looks professional and it kind of helps that she's right.
Yeah.
Right.
And really did there's no effort to humiliate in this, but to genuinely say, you can give them that out. Right? There's a way forward on this.
You could say this in so many, it's almost like a, a talk about toxic masculinity. It's like, yeah, if you block a merger, you're a tough enforcer. If you clear, you know, let's just say that you're not perceived as tough. Because what I want to really say is, if you clear, well, you're a wimp, you know. And it's like, that's, and then she says, that's not our policy.
Right.
Well, you know, we cannot, as a matter of principle.
There's a little human humor. I didn't realize she had a sense of humor. She says, I am told that Call of Duty is a very popular shooter franchise, but we found that Microsoft would probably not shoot itself in the foot by stopping sales to the much larger PlayStation base. I made a funny.
That's clink the glasses. That was a good one.
Yeah. This is a very, actually, I'm being silly because this is, you're right. I'm reading
it. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Great. It's really well spoken. Yeah. Makes a very strong case for the Brits to shape up or ship out. Well, too late for that.
Anyway, I'm glad she did it. I love her. She's great.
Yeah. And she's Danish, Leo, so you got to work on your Danish accent.
I don't I don't even know. Yeah. I don't have. All German's, I know is the Swedish chef. I can do that.
Dutch.
not the same thing at all.
It is the nexus between Sweden, Germany, and the Netherlands. It's kind of.
This is our duty, the Call of Duty. By the way, she ends her speech. Our mission is to accompany the transition. Our mission is to accompany that transition one merger at a time, is to find solutions that keep the game fair for all players, and working closely together with sister agencies as we do so. That is our Call of Duty.
Nicely done,
Margareta.
And she threw the microphone on the floor.
Mic drop.
And they were like, did she just refer to the CMA in feminine terms? Is that what she just did? Was that a little put down?
That's just a language difference between us.
Yeah.
She says the shifting sands of crisis and transition will set the agenda for mergers in the coming years. Since the pandemic, disruption has become the norm. There are shifts in how consumers shop, work, relax, and socialize. We should expect that in the years to come, this will lead to consolidation in traditional sectors, but also M&A in emerging sectors. Our mission is to accompany that transition. I don't know if accompany is the right translation there. Accommodate maybe would be better. One merger at a time.
Right. Not be dumb.
Not be dumb about it, you Brexiters. Yeah, they're trying to spread Brexit all over us. Stop it.
Right.
Keep it to yourself. We don't need your stinking Brexit.
We're all going to suffer.
Too funny.
Anyway, I thought that was fantastic.
Now,
the problem is, if I write about this, all I'm going to do is I should just quote what she said. There's nothing you can add to it.
It's
really
perfect.
Right?
No.
I mean,
yeah.
It's really it's almost
quite well said, I thought.
Yeah, editorial free.
Yeah, I mean, she's basically saying, no, you made a mistake, and we didn't make that mistake because this is why, you know. And so, I mean, there's nothing she can do about it.
Well,
it's a new month. One day from today, June. So do we have new games for gold titles, Mr. Paul Theroux?
Yeah, and I think we might have a first here. So Games with Gold, remember, used to be 4 free games a month for people who have Xbox Live Gold, and then eventually a Game Pass Ultimate as well. They ran out of legacy Xbox games to put in this program. So now it's newer Xbox One / Xbox Series X and S games. So there's only 2 per month now. So there's one that runs the entire month, and then there's one that runs for a month that goes from the middle of the month till the middle of the next month. I don't know why they stagger them. Anyway, the first of those two is something called Adios, which curiously does not take place in a Spanish-speaking place, but it's a first-person kind of cinematic thriller adventure game. It looks to me a lot like one of those Telltale games. It's not, though. It's actually a first-person game. So you walk through the areas, but the style of the graphics is very familiar to, or very similar to, Telltale games, like those Walking Dead games and so forth. It looks pretty cool. But the thing that's unique about it is, I think, I could be wrong, but I believe this is the first Games with Gold title that is also available free on Windows. So it's not just the console. And maybe it's just because it's a cross-platform game and that was its nature, but it actually looks pretty interesting. The other one is called The Veil, Shadow of the Crown, which I read as Veil, Shadow of the Corn, which I liked better, but it's in the shadow of the corn.
That's pretty so that's funny.
What's in your veil?
Yeah. And then also Microsoft has announced, because yeah, new month, the first batch of Game Pass titles is coming in the first half of June. This is a big list. I don't know that this happens to me a lot. I don't really recognize many of these. There's kind of a cute little watercolory game looking game called Dordogne, like in France, which I think looks kind of cool.
It's probably Rayman. It's a Rayman clone because Rayman's also French, you know?
I don't think it is.
No. It has that Rayman feel to it. I don't know.
Does it?
Okay. I haven't played the game. I'm just looking at the
topic. There's Amnesia on the list, and Amnesia is like this horror game series that I would never play. Right. It's not my thing at all.
Yeah, the bunker.
I guess that's one of the set.
Stacking, yep. Amnesia, the bunker, car mechanic simulator. Oh, how fun. 2021.
We're running out of stuff.
Yeah. What is, I can't even read that. Hypnotastic Outlaw? Hypnospace Outlaw.
Yep. This happens to me a lot these days. I don't recognize a lot of these games.
Yeah, The Big Con, Dordogne. You like that because it's got a French name.
Yep. I like the game Slayer's X because it has two colons in the name, which is, I think, is grammatically impossible.
Double colon.
You know, whatever.
Wow. Wow. Okay. And to gamers, anything's possible.
Slayer's X, Terminal Aftermath, Vengeance of the Slayer.
Double colon.
Yep.
And so what's this last one? I can't. Rune Factory Special.
Rune Factory 4 Special.
Rune Factory 4 Special.
I know.
Which looks like it's an anime title.
Like a Japanese kind of anime.
Everybody's got big eyes. So.
Next month we'll have Dishwasher Simulator 2023. Vacuum Simulator 2022.
I'm looking for a grease trap inspector.
Dog groomer simulator 2021.
Yeah. Hey, these are the big titles finally coming out. That's for your Game Pass.
Yep.
There is an update to the Xbox app.
It's going to be June tomorrow. So let's see, March, April, May. Yeah, sometime in the next day or two, I am going to hit the 3rd month anniversary of the last time I turned on my Xbox console. And I have been playing games on the PC. And the way I've been doing it mostly, not entirely, but mostly, is through the Xbox app on the PC. And the Xbox, I don't know why I just said it like that, the Xbox app is kind of like a software console, right? It's like the Xbox console, right? It's kind of a similar UI. And
this is kind of stunning news.
Yeah,
I know. You will play Call of Duty that way? You have Call of Duty running on the Xbox? You're playing on your PC?
No, I don't play Call of Duty. I haven't played Call of Duty since March 2nd, I think.
Oh, I see.
Is this just a side effect of moving? Like you haven't unpacked your Xbox?
No, it's right there. I can see it. I could turn it on if I wanted to. I'm making the effort, you know. I get a lot of criticism for only playing Call of Duty. I can't understand that. It's obviously the only game that matters, and I've been verifying that over the past 3 months. But I've been trying different things, and you know, older games, obviously, you have to play like you would back in the day, or people do on PCs, you know, keyboard, mouse. But I prefer to play with the controller if I can do it. I've been playing that Halo Infinite game, I got to tell you.
It's going to catch on one of these days?
No, it's not. And I don't know how you fix that. It's I think Halo has kind of played out. I appreciate that it's Halo. You know, it's Halo, the music, it's perfect. It's like bum 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 bum. You know, the music kicks in. It's nicely done, but it's the same damn game. Like it's just you know, the same thing over and over again. So
yeah,
I'm kind of, I don't know what to do with that. I think they need some new blood there, and go in some different directions.
Well, the team's been dispersed. Like there's never going to be another Halo game. Like it's the same way that there's never going to be another
like Half-Life or
any of those, right? Like those teams don't exist anymore. They make something new. There's no point.
You know what I'm loving, and you recommended this ages ago, and I'm just now getting around to reading Masters of Doom.
Yeah. Oh my God.
A great book. The story of Carmack Romero.
If I'm not mistaken, the audiobook is read by Will Wheaton.
Will Wheaton.
Yeah. Well, I'm not, you know, he's a little arch in his style. He's not my favorite. You know, it's some almost, yeah. He's doing well, a comic reading of it a little bit.
He does Ready Player One, I think,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That was okay. Does he do the new version of the Martian? Is that him?
No.
You know, it used to be, it was.
Oh, you're right. I think they got Will Wheaton to do it.
I think so.
Oh, that's
I like the
bad.
Original guy.
The original guy was escaping. Perfect.
He was perfect. I will never forget listening to that. I was laughing out loud so much. We were in Barcelona, and I kept quoting from it to my family. It was probably like, seriously. But I just thought it was the funniest thing in the world. Yeah, and they did a movie version, which was okay. It was fine, you know, but it just nothing can compare with the original reading of that.
Yeah, because he had the voice. He was perfect.
Yeah. Yeah,
But I guess I don't know. Maybe you can't.
He does the Mountain Man books? R.C. Bray.
R.C. Bray.
Am I weird for just reading the book?
Yeah.
What is this, the 19th century? What do you read by a candle? What's wrong with you?
Yeah. No, I don't need to. I have a Kindle.
Yeah. No, I kind of go back and forth depending on the book. I'll listen to if there is an audiobook version. I'll listen to the clip to see if I like the guy's voice or the person's voice. And if I don't, I'll read the book.
You know what? Sometimes I'll do is buy both because you get a discount if you buy both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and Amazon, that's a nice handoff.
You got to do it in the right order, though.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah. You got to
buy the audiobook first.
It's cheaper. I think it's the other way. I could be wrong. I think it's cheaper.
Look at that. Will Wheaton is now reading it.
It is Will Wheaton. Yeah.
Okay. I'm glad I have the library, the R.C. Bray version.
R.C. Bray is the one you want. Yep. Classic.
That's a little disappointing.
Yeah.
R.C. must have moved on or something.
It wasn't his fault. He addressed this on his blog back in the day. I can't remember the reason. I think it was a license thing with the publishing companies. It ran out or something. It was some weird reason. But
I'll have to. You know, I've had Andy on the show a couple of times. Andy Weir. I'll have to ask him. Actually, I've had him on three times. Yeah. I think.
He may not have been involved. Publishers are funny that way, right?
Like, well, Project Hail Mary did not have R.C. Bray. It had Ray Porter, who was also very good as the reader.
Does that guy do his other books, too? Because I feel like they might have moved on to...
Rosario Dawson did the Artemis.
Interesting. Okay.
And then Will Wheaton does The Martian. There are other older stuff, but I don't think any of that really counts. Because it's short stories. R.C. Bray did a book called The Egg, which I'm not familiar with.
So he does the Mountain Man
series. That was a short story.
Yeah.
Actually, you would like this, Richard.
Yeah, it's 8 minutes long.
There's a Canadian zombie series called Mountain Man. The Mountain Man, which he does those books. Those are fantastic. There's a free one. You can just listen to the first one. It's free. It's called The Hospital.
Do you not do audiobooks at all, Richard?
No, I read fast.
Yeah.
I plow through my Kindle on flights, two or three books in a long flight.
I'm going to do it on Ask the Tech Guys on Saturday to review. I bought the Kindle Scribe. That's the one with the pen that you write on.
Cool.
I like it because it's big. It's like 8x10. So, that's a disadvantage because it's heavier and stuff, but I kind of like the bigger page.
Yeah. So,
anyway,
I one hand my Kindle Paperwhite on lots of flights.
Yeah.
If I am dragged off to vacation, then I'll typically have Kindle in one hand, phone in the other, taking notes.
Okay. Interesting.
Anyway, where were we?
We went off on a
tangent.
6 degrees of Kevin Bacon there. But the reason I talked about the Xbox, the reason I didn't talk about the Xbox app was that it's been updated. So there's a May update out. None of this looks really like a big deal to me, but there's a new discovery interface, new accessibility options, new social stuff, which I never look at anyway. So not too much. But if you do use the Xbox app on Windows, you'll get an update soon. So. Not a big deal. It's just that it happened. And Google is also working to bring their own kind of PC game store to the PC, obviously. And it's called the Google Play Games for PC app. It's not streaming. It is some form of virtualization, basically. Not the one built into Windows, by the way, which is goofy. But, you know, Google and Microsoft don't work together. It is now available in two more countries, New Zealand and... Oh, actually, two more countries. Sorry. New Zealand and then 40 European countries. So I guess 41 new countries. So it wasn't available previously in Europe, obviously. It is available already in Australia, Canada, Japan, South Korea, and the United States.
Is this functionally equivalent to the crappy Kindle store that the official Android apps come from? Or
Yeah, I think it's comparable from a technology perspective. The question is whether the quality of the selection is any better. Right. It would have to be, right?
Right.
Anyone who has looked at the Amazon App Store in the that comes with the WSA, right, the Windows subsystem for Android, will know that it is horrifically bad. And God, I'd give anything for Microsoft and Google to get their acts together, because it would be a really neat thing. Even if you had to pay for it, you know, you pay for like a Google Play license or whatever to get it. I think millions of people would do that to be able to get access to Google Maps and Gmail and whatever other apps on their Windows devices.
Do you think Microsoft is blocking them from doing that, or is it a Google?
No, I think it's Google. I think Microsoft would do it. This is all coming from Google.
But Microsoft clearly doesn't want to pay Google the license for the Google
Play. I don't know that. I don't know. I will tell you that when Google reached out to me when they first announced this, they sent me a little like preview version of the press release. And then they came back and they said, hey, hold on a second. Here's a new version. And I looked at it and I said, I don't understand. These look identical to me. What's the difference? And they said, oh, we wanted to make it clear that we are not using the Windows subsystem for Linux or for Android. And I was like, okay. Why wouldn't you use the thing that's built into Windows? They don't work with Microsoft. They hate each other.
Well, some groups do.
Yeah, right. No, of course. I mean, the browser teams, right, are partnering. There's a little
generally get along,
but at a very high level,
that's because they can both hate Apple together.
That's right. Yeah, but I think there's a big chunk of Google's identity is built around the notion of we do not trust Microsoft. They came up in that age when Microsoft was getting destroyed by all the antitrust stuff, and they were like, nope, we are not. We just don't trust them. And it's 20 years later, you know, it actually doesn't make sense anymore.
Right.
But it's like it's built into their DNA. They just don't trust Microsoft.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
You got to get over it. It's a different Microsoft.
It's a different world.
They're the kinder, gentler tech giant.
Yeah.
Now, they're making Google repeatedly run into a door frame over search is hilarious. For us, anyway, but you know, right. Okay, I get you're a little annoyed.
Actually, yeah, that's the battle now, isn't it? Yeah. Bing versus Google Search, yeah, and ChatGPT versus Bard.
Yeah,
right.
We okay? You know, I don't think so. I don't think we're okay.
No, we're not okay. Red alert! Red alert! Right. Klingons off the starboard bow. I will say that one of the things reading Masters of Doom made me want to do is download Wolfenstein 3D and play it again.
I have played through all their three big games, right? The Wolfenstein, Doom, and Quake. And they're
loved Quake. Loved it.
I have played those games each possibly easily dozens of times, but possibly hundreds in some cases. I go back and replay those from time to time. It's just they're just classic.
Yeah.
Classic.
And they launched the era of first-person shooters. Mm-hmm. So,
oh my God,
if you like Call of Duty, it's a direct descendant of Wolfenstein 3D.
That's right. That was kind of the transition. I mean, there were a couple of games in between. There was Medal of Honor right before there was Call of Duty, when the Call of Duty team was largely based on the team that made Medal of Honor.
Well, and you knew they grew up playing Wolfenstein and Doom, right?
They also grew up watching those Time Life commercials where it was like the plane goes by and it's like, he was a monster. So Hitler, you know. They're like, man, this would make a great game.
Well, it's fascinating to read how controversial it was. I mean, they really were the first extremely violent game. Yeah. The game that showed blood, for instance.
Well, I told you this very early when we first started doing the show a million years ago. I was saying, you know, killing Nazis is almost victim free. Like it's almost as close as you can get. But then they came up with the zombie game and it was like zombie Nazis. I'm like, they nailed it. There's no guilt. No guilt here.
And so I'm at this chapter right now where they're getting a lot of complaints, not because you're killing Nazis or because it's bloody, but because you're killing Nazi dogs and people don't want you to kill animals. You can kill
that
all
game was banned in Germany because they can't have the Nazi swastikas. Iconic.
Yeah. CompuServe, they said, because remember, it was a shareware, so it was a download. CompuServe banned the download because of that.
I'm reading a book about shareware right now, and it's just gotten into the Apogee stuff and John Carmack.
Yep.
That this model, you know, how do you make money selling software when there's a lot of stuff is free? And this notion that you could give away the first part of the game and sell the other two-thirds.
They solved it.
It was a guy from Apogee. I can't remember his name, but it was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And And it just worked for so many companies and for so many people. It was just a great
model. Before Apogee, there was SoftDisk. Mm-hmm. And yep. SoftDisk was a shareware company. Most of their titles were
but a lot of utilities. It was like you would ship them a disk and it would say, hey, you send me some money. You know, donate, please.
Right.
Please pay for this.
Right.
And some people would, you know.
Right.
You'd make like $8 or $16
it's
a month
like
or whatever.
Club Twit. You know, it's like 1% would pay
some
for it.
Some people would do it.
It's fine.
Yeah. But the shareware model was just genius.
Right.
So yeah. Smart. I got the first Doom. I wasn't Wolfenstein, but I got the first set of Doom, the original Doom from Mesquite, Texas, right?
Yeah.
In the mail because I sent them a check.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. That's how you got it. You mailed them a check and they mailed you a floppy disk back.
Apogee didn't have a computer network, so they would take the order on a piece of paper and put it on a spike.
No, this was like 1993. There was no like internet to speak of. I mean, there was, but yeah. No, this is how that worked.
Not a thing.
Yeah, we got an order for were you in New Mexico then or were you in Denham already? We got an order from this guy, Paul Thurrott.
I was in Phoenix by the point.
Phoenix.
Yeah, Phoenix.
We're going to, all right. He's going to send us a check, but put that on the spike.
That was the first time. I was on BBS's at the time. And so one of my big deals.
You could download it from BBS's. Yeah.
Well, I had to find, well, here's why I mailed the desk. So they would charge you for it. Like, so you could get on for free, but you could only be on for an hour. So what would happen is I would start I would download things like
shoot.
Jill of the Jungle and all these MS-DOS games, and they wouldn't complete in an hour.
Yeah.
So I'd have to come back after 24 hours and it would remember it. It would actually have part of it.
You could
and
resume.
Then finish it.
Yeah.
Some of these games would take two, 3 days.
Z modem, which would resume.
Okay. I don't remember.
My watch thinks I just hit myself. I did not fall. Yeah, I just
Phoenix Developers BBS, I think was the name of one of them.
Yeah.
But you know, I just couldn't afford to pay for it.
Think
so
far we've come. The other day I was looking at this and going, we've come a long way. It was like a 278 megabyte download. And it came in seconds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, though, back in the day, I would have been calling back the next day to get the second half.
Right.
After an hour. We've come such a long way and we take it for granted. It's a.
Sure.
Those instant downloads. A lot of what we do today, if we didn't have huge bandwidth, would be very difficult. You know, all the stuff that.
Remember, like, if you would print something out and it would kind of print like one pixel line at a time and
head
to go back and the net, right? So you watch this kind of image like slowly appear.
Yeah.
I was in a computer lab in Scottsdale. We were downloading off of Usenet and it was these guys. Just, I'm like, what are you doing? They're like, oh, we found like a pornography thing. I'm like, okay. And we're watching this thing come out like one line at a time.
Sassy porn.
And it's like, oh, guys, come on. Like, you know. Yeah. And then eventually you'd see the person's face. You'd be like, oh, what? Stop. So like we stood here for 43 minutes and then canceled it, you know, and it was just stupid.
It's not that stupid.
Now we can get to stupid quick. It's nice.
Yeah, you get stupid instantly. Here's the Apogee.
Waiting for stupid.
Somebody has linked this in our Discord, the official Apogee FAQ featuring 3D Realms and Pinball Wizards. This is from 10 years later, though. That's the thing. This is 2005.
Yeah.
So Apogee, you know, Doom Apogee and Quake and all that. That was huge. It was really huge.
3D Realms.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. What a war. And we were happy.
listen. The genius of John Carmack was that he made a lowly PC output graphics that were impossible on an Amiga, or, you know, later they did. Yeah. But, you know, you just knew you were watching something amazing happening.
Yeah.
You know,
one of the best minds. And when he had to write that letter to say to Zuck, you've wasted a tremendous amount of money and I won't be party to it. You have to take the man seriously. You know, it's some of the best software ever made in the world. He knows about running teams.
Yep. And he's spent the past 7 years dealing with your bureaucracy. And I'm telling you, it stinks.
Mm. Yeah. What's happening here is not good.
Let's be fair. Carmack was always a bit of a maverick.
He was a curmudgeon.
And kind of a dick. Yeah. I mean.
Yeah. That doesn't make him wrong.
Doesn't make him wrong. I agree.
That's right.
I agree. Right. Hey, let's take a little break. That is the extended, now enhanced, expanded Xbox edition. I'm happy
now
to say.
Now including audiobook picks.
Yeah, all sorts of stuff. Our tips and picks of the week coming up in just a little bit. Plus a brown liquor pick of the week. And Mr. Red Flannel Shirt here has got a tip for you, but first a word, if you don't mind, if you gentlemen would allow me, from our fine
sponsor those great folks at CDW and Lenovo. Lenovo orchestrated by the experts at CDW. The helpful people at CDW understand that as the world changes, your organization needs to adapt quickly to be successful. So, how can CDW keep your business ahead of the curve? Baby, with Lenovo ThinkPads like these, I love my ThinkPad. These powerful devices deliver the business class performance you're looking for thanks to Windows 10 and the Intel Evo platform. With your remote teams working across the country, around the world, collaboration, not a problem. Because Lenovo ThinkPads keep your organization productive and connected from anywhere. Plus, CDW knows your workforce has differing work styles, needs flexibility, right? That's why Lenovo ThinkPads are equipped with responsive tools and built-in features that let your team work seamlessly across their favorite tools. Now, think about that for a second. Oh, let's not forget about security. These high-performing machines protect at the highest level with built-in hardware to guard against modern threats without slowing your team down. So when you need to get more out of your technology, Lenovo makes seamless productivity possible. CDW makes it powerful. Learn more at cdw.com/Lenovo client. That's cdw.com/Lenovo client. Let's not forget that address. If you use that address, they will know you saw it here. Now, little Pauly Thurrott has a little tip he'd like to share with you. Pauly, tell the people about your tip.
My tip is, if you want to get started on what's coming next for Windows 11, you need to get into the Insider program somehow.
I just got out of the Insider program.
I know. But there's some interesting stuff coming. You know, Windows 11 wasn't super interesting for a while there. It's about to get really interesting.
I
mentioned earlier in the show that in the Dev channel, they have Dev Drive, the Windows backup feature, which we may or may not have talked about, the never combined functionality in the taskbar that's available today. Sometime in the next 2 weeks, you're going to get Windows Copilot. So if you want to get that as soon as it happens, you might want to get going on that.
Get going.
Microsoft did release an ISO of the latest build for the Dev channel. They don't always do that. In fact, sometimes it goes months and months. But this particular build is available in ISO form. So if you want to do it a little more, well, I don't know if that's quickly or not, but if you want to put it into a virtual machine, it will certainly be quicker than, you know, installing Windows 11 and then upgrading it. So grab the ISO if you want that. The way to find that, actually, I have the URL, but it's what you're looking for is Windows Insider Preview ISO. Just Google that and you'll get the URL. It's easy enough.
Cool.
Yeah.
I wish to do it, I guess. You've talked me into it. Won't be the first thing you've talked me into.
I'm worried about the legal responsibility of that. But okay.
No. I won't hold you accountable, although we do have a recording.
There have been multiple
times
over the history of the show where you've come back later and said, but you said.
You told me.
But you said.
No. It's okay.
DevDrive is very interesting to me, actually.
Yeah.
The backup, that's cool. You can now back up Windows like you would your phone, which is great.
Yep.
Cloud backup.
Yep. Probably. Which is weird because, you know, in Windows 11, they took a back step from the setting sync stuff. But I think maybe this is why. Maybe they always intended to do something like this instead.
All right. So I am already on Windows 11, so I just have to go into...
you could do it through the Windows Update interface.
Yeah. Just say, hey, okay, you had me at Refs. How do you pronounce that now? Refs. Refs. R-E-F-S. Rufus.
Well, we can't say Rufus because Rufus is a
different
thing.
There's a Rufus. Yeah.
Cool.
Rufus. Yeah. Refus. Refuse.
So from an app pick perspective, I actually kind of have three. These are going to seem a little goofy in a way, but there are these functions that I have to use all the time that I just find to be really slow using the tools built into Windows and or inadequate in some fashion, right? And they are snipping tool, photos, and media player. I don't like these apps. I keep giving them a shot. They keep betraying me. So I use alternatives. So for the snipping tool, which is the screenshot replacement, and by the way, as of moment three, it becomes a screenshot replacement, the print screen replacement. I use a tool called GreenShot. It's free. And all of these are free, I should say. It's a great tool. It's super customizable. You can capture the mouse cursor, which is something I do need or not. You know, it's your choice. For image viewing, I use something called Image Glass. This is a wonderful minimalist application. I use it full screen and without the toolbar. So basically, when I double click on an image, it pops up full screen. Hit escape, it disappears. It's awesome. It's just like a, it's like the Mac preview, image preview function. It's just really, really nice. And then for the media player, I use VLC, obviously. And VLC has an added bonus. I have occasionally will review a laptop, which this doesn't make sense. This is like one of those, it goes up to 11 moments, but it, you can actually put the volume up above 100%. And I know what you're saying. I know what you're thinking. The volume can only go to some percentage, but it actually does play media louder. And I feel like there some apps just, I don't know if they have volume limiters or whatever, but sometimes I'll play a movie in media player and it just isn't loud. But if I play the same video in YouTube, it's louder, even though the quality's less. So I don't know. There's something about VLC that just seems to handle volume really, really well. We talked on past shows about things like WinGet, which is a command line tool, and WinGet UI, which is a kind of a front web-based front end. You can install all these things in one whack. Just create a little install script and pump it through the command line and bump, 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 there it goes. And that's how I bring up my machines now. I've been doing that now for probably at least a month or two. I have a big install script for all of the apps that I use, and it just becomes part of my, it just makes my day one kind of thing much quicker and easier. But you could download them from the web too, obviously.
What's your time to
Luddite?
When what's your time to a usable machine then, right?
About an hour.
Good
Lord.
A
vendor sends you a machine to explore. Fire this up, and within an hour, it's ready.
It's not bad. The one piece that's missing is that thing we were kind of talking about earlier. Yeah. It's the config bit.
Yeah.
So obviously, all of these apps you have to sign in, and you know some of them require manual configuration. It'd be really neat if we could do some kind of a user state something. There.
Aren't they in WinGet? I mean, I'm sure they're in Chocolate.
They're all in WinGet, right? They don't maintain your.
It's not automatic.
Oh, you mean not your configuration? Like I still, you know, if I go into Visual Studio Code, I have to sign into GitHub. Signing into GitHub will sync all my settings and my extensions and all that. So that's kind of nice. But that's like an app by app basis. I sign into Brave, and that brings down all the stuff I sync.
And it's that's true of all the on machine versions of Office too. You have to open each one of them.
Yep.
And then configuring.
It's like seriously, there's got to be a better way to do this.
Yeah.
But anyway. Well, it's a step in the right direction.
Maybe this new
nobody's incented.
Dev config will do it. Can I ask a question, Mr. T? Mm-hmm. Which channel, insider channel, should I be? Canary, Dev, Beta, or Release? There's four.
Well, this is the thing. So I'm assuming it's going to come out in Dev.
It says Dev channel recommended.
No, I know, but
Canary is for highly technical users. Like, it would be a little buggy, maybe,
You'd like your machine to crash all the time.
Right. So, there's Microsoft. Yeah, it's impossible to tell. So far, since Canary's been a thing, Canary's only been a thing since, I think, January, maybe. A lot of new features actually pop up first on Dev for some reason. You would think it would not be that way, but it is. The new Windows 11 features they were talking about at Build, they appeared in Dev, not in Canary.
Okay.
They're actually not in Canary. They're not in both. They're just only in Dev. So, we have to guess, and my educated guess is Dev is the right place to be.
All right. It is recommended. Beta is ideal for early adopters. Release preview is ideal if you want to preview fixes and certain key features. Dev sounds good for me. I want it to be stable enough because this is the machine I use for the show that I can,
Yeah. I mean, just be comfortable with the notion that if I'm wrong, and I'm never wrong, but if I am, that... You might have to wipe.
Rough edges and low stability.
Yeah. That's me. Oh, you mean the Dev thing. Yeah. Yep, that too.
All right, I'm going for it.
All right. Bye-bye. You'll be away from it.
All right. Clear, I did not explicitly recommend that you do this.
Yes, you did. It was Paul's thoughts.
I'm just asking questions, and you went to the logical
I always conclusion. Do what you tell me to, Paul. Okay. No, but you made a compelling case. There was no reason for me to be in the insider channel for moment three a week ahead of time.
Exactly. Can you imagine if you were testing seconds in the clock? That's what you did?
That's the test.
What a waste of time.
But I'm very interested in these newest tools they announced, including the
maybe
AI.
When we have an NPU, we could display seconds in the clock and have it not affect the battery. Maybe that's the reason we're getting an NPU. It's for seconds in the clock.
All right. This is my production
I don't understand
machine.
How AI works. I hope that's clear by now.
Yeah. No one
but
does.
Maybe.
That's the point.
Maybe.
The whole point of AI is nobody knows.
Right.
It's a mystery.
We accept that there are smart people out there, and we hope they know what they're doing.
Run as radio. You know, run as radio time. Let's see what Richard's got coming up on RAR.
For the end of May, one of our 5 show weeks, I have Aiden Finn coming back. I called the show Azure Sticker Shock. So in the story arcs of we're coming out of the pandemic, let's clean up our mess. One of the mess you have is a lot of lift and shifted VMs getting out of the on-prem servers and into the cloud because we needed more computer resources for one reason or another. And they're finding out, boy, that stuff's expensive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the sticker shock part. And so part of the conversation with Aiden was, A, being able to find out before the bill arrives how much you're spending. Mm-hmm. So getting into some of the dashboards around cost management and being able to set rules. So it's like, hey, this stuff normally costs this much. If it jumps up for some reason, I'd like to be notified. But then also to get into more of the cloud as architecture, that if you've just hauled a bunch of VMs into the cloud, you're kind of buying it the most expensive way. And here are some tools and approaches to moving up the stack where you're reserving fewer resources from Azure so your bill actually goes down.
Okay.
And that sort of combination of better tooling to measure your pricing, breaking it out by resource area or different areas of responsibility, and then being able to show where modernization makes a lot of sense, where even taking the VMs and just turning them down a couple of notches, because we tend to provision for peak when we're on-prem. The process of installing a server is so arduous, you might as well overbuy the server. Where the process of selecting a VM in Azure is trivial. And if you simply match your hardware to the VM in the cloud, you're probably over-provisioning it. So just turning those things down.
Is what I just heard.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to go to the cloud to save money. Oh, no, I need the best VM.
Yeah, but I'm going to jack it all up. And just the little ones like, oh, we like that feature. Turn it on without any assessment of its cost. And so, you know, setting cost monitoring up in the cost management tools, you suddenly flick a feature on and the price per day doubled. And so within a couple of days, you get a warning saying, hey, you know, this thing you said was costing us only X many dollars a month. Well, it's costing twice that. Just thought you'd like to know.
Eesh.
And maybe you can go back and say, hey, you turned on a feature you didn't understand the cost of.
Yeah.
And that those are all part of it. So, I mean, Aiden's one of those guys that's in the trenches. You know, he works for Innofactor Norway with Azure infrastructure projects all over Europe. And these are the conversations he's having with his customers and exactly the help he's providing. So, you know, he was just someone who's like, here's how I deal with this with my customers and you can do it too.
Run as radio.
He's Irish, so he's in the EU, not the UK.
That is correct, because he is in Dublin.
Yeah, all right. Azure really Sticker Shock with Aiden Finn. Does he have a nice Irish accent?
He sure
does. It's very mild, actually.
Yeah, nice. I like it.
It's very soothing.
Yeah.
Soothing, yeah. Irish accent. Speaking of soothing, I think we should go to Canada.
Yeah, I think it was time. It was time to, I mean, I've mentioned Canadian whiskeys on the show before, but I thought, you know, in part of our Understanding Whiskey series, and we've talked, obviously, we spent a lot of time, although I understand the video is just about ready on Scottish whiskey. They're going to actually put up that playlist.
Yay.
And then I talked about American and the differences there. And we talked about Japanese and the differences there. And then we talked about Irish and the differences there. So we should talk about Canadian, because Canadian whiskey has been around for a couple hundred years. It's distinct. It has some very unusual attributes I think you'll enjoy. But I don't know that you can really grapple with Canadian whiskey if you don't really grapple with Canada. So that's why I put the flannel.
Canada.
So if we go back a bit, you know, I mean, I'd be remiss not to start with the Indigenous peoples, right? Like Canada's been
the first nation.
That land's been populated. First Nations, we're now finding through archaeological digs, millennia of people living on the land, even before the Bering Strait at the end of the last ice age. Now we found even older peoples that were on the land.
That's so cool. That's very cool.
That there were cities built in North America before Europeans arrived. They died. They collapsed for various reasons. Famously, in the 1960s, we found L'Anse aux Meadows. This is that little part in northern Newfoundland, where the Vikings actually established a a colony for a period and then discovered, hey, there are very capable indigenous people and they don't like us very much, and they moved on. At least that's the proposal. I remember reading a translated document of the Viking efforts working their way across the North Atlantic, getting to Greenland, Iceland and Greenland and so forth. And they describing an Inuit. And at the time, of course, the Inuit are these seafaring people using kayaks and mostly sealskins and so forth. So an Inuit in a kayak is all one piece. And the Viking didn't quite understand that's a guy in a boat. He's just like, this was a funny looking creature. He had head and arms, but had this thing. But it ends with, I poked him with a spear and he bled a lot like a person, but not the same. You know, because that's how you communicate with people. Great strategy.
They're like the Harley Davidson guys from you know, but with boats.
Exactly. So fast forward to the 1500s, the French and the English are exploring and colonizing and interacting with the native peoples. In fact, the only walled city in all of North America is Quebec City. At the end of the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is on that side is all salt, even though it's a part of a river, the first choke point where it gets narrow enough and really becomes the St. Lawrence River, that's where they built their very first city, and it was defending the entrance to the St. Lawrence Seaway. And so much production and development. The English controlled more of the upper part of the waterway, and they were big on taking sugar out of the Caribbean, and they would bring it up to those lands to actually process into rum. And, you know, things come to a head in 1755 with what is known in Europe as the Seven Years' War, but in North America, it was known as the French and Indian War. And this is the war, by the way, that trained a lot of American military for getting ready for the Revolutionary War a few years further on.
Are you taking credit for this now? Is that what I just heard?
Just letting you know that this is these histories are intertwined, as are the whiskeys, right? Famously, this is also as the English are winning in these conflicts. They start trying to push the French out, who are refusing to acquiesce to George II, which you folks didn't want to do either. And that's the Acadians that get pushed out in the chunks of land that are Maine and Nova Scotia and so forth, some of which most of them will be sent back to France. And then when the French didn't want them because it sucks to be a refugee, they actually made a deal and shipped a bunch of them to Louisiana. And those become the Cajuns.
My family stayed in Quebec, the Laportes, that we were the original part of that group.
And that really gets to the reality century. Of, you know, at the end of that war, in the Treaty of Paris, the end of that war, you have both French and Canadians, French and English living together. Even if their nations don't get along particularly well, they're just trying to survive. Colonies is a tough environment. And in the midst of all of this, it comes a young man named John Molson. And yeah, it's that Molson.
Yep.
He's a fifth son. His parents have died, although they were very well-to-do. So he has a trust fund. And as fifth sons do, he goes to the colonies. He has an education in brewing and he starts working. He immigrates to Quebec City and he starts running an existing beer operation, ultimately takes it over by 1785, creates the Molson Company, which is now the second oldest company in all of Canada, predating Confederation itself, the oldest being the Hudson's Bay Company.
Yeah. Wow.
By 1791, we've split what will eventually be Canada, it's still not Canada, into what's called Upper and Lower Canada. Lower Canada being further north because directions are hard, and Upper Canada being further up the Ottawa River. I mean, eventually we'll call these Ontario and Quebec, but we're not there yet. And in one of the many trips that John Molson, being a successful brewer, is involved in, he brings some whiskey in from England and decides that this is pretty good stuff. And so decides to repurpose a British rum still to make whiskey from grain, wheat primarily. At the time, wheat crops were bumper. This is 1799. And so they were literally going to rot. And rather than let them rot, they fermented them and made them into pretty harsh whiskey. But it's the beginning of that. And that's in the Kingston, Ontario area, which is basically when you get to the end of the St. Lawrence River and it opens into Lake Ontario, that's where Kingston is. And so by 1801, they have a steady whiskey production. Now, Whiskey is pretty successful, so a bunch of other companies jump on board. By the War of 1812, between the English and the Americans, the Canadians are happily selling beer and whiskey to both. Pretty quickly, Molson gets more focused on beer than whiskey. The big whiskey makers in Canada in the early 1800s were groups like Hiram Walker, which you'll know by their product Canadian Club, and Joseph Seagram's, who famously makes the Seagram's VO, although by the 1930s, they will make a very well-known whiskey.
Saying Hiram Walker and Seagram's are both Canadian?
They're Canadians, yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. The liquor barons.
And in 1861, when the Civil War breaks out and you're all distracted from making your own booze, we happily sell it to you because that's the business. And by the time the Civil War is over, around the time that Canada actually becomes Canada, Confederation doesn't come until 1867. Our first set of rules for making whiskey come in 1875. And this is when they define Canadian whiskey. Now, at the time, Canadian whiskey was primarily made with wheat and corn because it's inexpensive. And they would add a little rye to it because it tasted good. And so most whiskey was referred to as either Canadian whiskey, Canadian rye whiskey, or rye whiskey, even though the rye only made a small portion of it. And to qualify as Canadian whiskey, it had to be mashed, distilled, and aged in Canada and be at least 40% alcohol. Barrels no larger than 700 liters, and I'm going to stick with liters because Canada, get over it. Although they didn't have any requirement for charring or anything like that, you could use raw wood and a minimum of 3 years. So the specs are pretty loose. You could pretty much do what you want with Canada, and it would get crazier from there. One of the distinctive aspects of Canadian whiskey, which persists to this day, is that they would tend to distill and barrel each grain independently. So where the Americans with bourbon will make a mash bill, right, where they'll actually combine corn and rye and barley together, the Canadians would tend to do them separately and then use different barrelings for them to combine before they would actually combine them. They did, of course, use American bourbon barrels because the Americans, like crazy people, would only use their barrels once. And why waste a good barrel? That the Canadian line was bourbon is the leftover stuff in a barrel now mature enough for Canadian whiskey. the other technique that Canadians to this day still do is they'll actually do split distillations and barrelings. So they'll use their grains, typically corn today, although more wheat back in the day, and they'll do a high distillation with that, get it up into the 70s, 80s, even 90s, then cut it with water and put it into the used bourbon barrels. That's that old 64% trick we talked about, where just slightly stronger than what American bourbon would use to pull new flavors out. But then they'd also use a low distillate, only 40 or 50%, a little more flavorful. And they put those in newer barrels, because if you put the high distillate in new barrels, you get very harsh flavors. But if you put low distillates in new barrels, you get good flavors and you mature the barrel as well. And then afterward, they would combine them together. And that is one of the things that makes Canadian whiskey distinct, is that they do these separate barrelings and then combining. Although there are many ways to get about this that the Scots do and so forth with their combined barrelings. But the split distillation is a little more unusual. We got to talk about Prohibition. We're into the 1920s. Now, Canada flirted with Prohibition as well. You know, coming out of World War One, everybody's a little upset, something about a pandemic and so forth. And so a lot of drinking going on. Canada never had a national prohibition. Different provinces had different rules. But one of the things we never got around to was banning making booze, even when we did have Prohibition. We just couldn't buy it ourselves, but we'd happily sell it to somebody else. And even when Prohibition largely went away in Canada, it was still going on in the U.S. And so being neighbors with the largest undefended border in the world, we supplied you a lot of booze.
Is that true, really? The largest undefended border?
Undefended border in the world. Is Canada as an enabler.
Oh, 100%. And so,
it's like my neighbor who's rail thin, but bakes cookies every week.
Yeah.
They're pushers. They're pushers. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
It looks like you're having a little civil war. How would you like some whiskey?
Yeah. We can help. We're here to help.
We got them. And we make it here.
But in the early days of Prohibition, when pretty quickly, you know, the U.S. came to Canada and said, hey, you really have to stop selling whiskey down here. So we made it illegal to sell whiskey to Americans, and did not wanting to break the law. What we'd do then is we'd load up ships full of our whiskey and we'd take them 3 miles offshore, which eventually got to be known as the rum line, because right. now it's in international waters, and then Americans would come and buy it perfectly legal from the Canadians. What they do with that, not our problem. So eventually they put a squash on that. It said, no, it has to be foreign exported only. You can only sell it foreign export. Well, that leads us to St. Pierre and Miquelon. So there's these two islands about 16 miles off the south coast of Newfoundland that are French. They're still French protectorates to this day. You get a stamp on your passport if you take the ferry across to them. So during the period of Prohibition, the Canadians would ship all of their whiskey to France. They'd ship it in, and they built these huge warehouses on these teeny little islands, exported all the booze to France, so totally illegal, taxed and everything. The French, of course, refused Prohibition in any respect because that's insane. Why would you do that? And then the Americans would buy it and do something with it. Nobody really knew.
Sure. Medicine, you know, mostly.
We'd go somewhere. In 1930 alone, they figured 2 million gallons of whiskey flowed through St. Pierre.
Wow.
This tiny little island off the coast of Newfoundland that just was this. And for 10 plus years, everybody quit. It used to be a cod fishery, right? Everybody just was in the booze import-export
What's
business.
The economy like there now?
A little rough, you know. And the funny part, of course,
home destination.
They went through a pretty serious depression. Of course, it was a depression also.
Yeah.
Then they did well in World War II because they were a good port. They're a good deep water port, and so they were needed for a bunch of things. But it took a while to get back into the fishing industry. It's mostly tourism there today. Okay. And by most standards, and I think the Walker folks still celebrate this, Canadian Club, the number one most smuggled whiskey during U.S. Prohibition.
Love it.
So post-Prohibition, everybody's getting back into the business again. Apparently, there was a period there where American distilleries that were being rebuilt actually started bottling Canadian whiskey and calling it American because the Canadian stuff had more time to mature. And as protectionism came in the 1950s, they started making more rules about importing booze. They made an exception for the Canadians. They called it the 111 rule. So this was a U.S. Congress law that said, yes, we are going to tax imported booze unless 1/11th of it is American booze.
1/11th.
1/11th.
What a strange number.
And so what did the Canadians start doing? Well, the Canadians started buying inexpensive bourbon and tipping in a little bit of it into their barrels, and then they would have that tax exemption to sell into America.
Incredible.
Fast forward to 2009, and they recodified that rule. It's now called the 909 rule, or 9.09% rule, which, by the way, is 1/11th. The exact description is Canadian whiskey can be called Canadian whiskey if it's being exported. You're not allowed to use this for domestic consumption at a limit, and it's allowed to have up to 9.09% of imported spirits in it. But those spirits must be at least 2 years old. So you can't just dump corn grain alcohol into it. You can't dump mezcal in it, although there are some aged mezcals that now qualify. And a couple of nutty Canadian distilleries have done this. But here's the thinking. If I'm making a whiskey and I decide to age it in a bourbon cask, that bourbon cask is still wet with the bourbon in the wood. How much bourbon's in my whiskey anyway?
Right.
Or if I age it in a sherry cask. So let me introduce you to a whiskey you cannot buy. I'm just going to leave with that, not to upset you, called Alberta Premium Dark Horse Rye. It would have been my whiskey of the week if I could have laid my hands on it. It has not been available in ages. 90% of it, standard Canadian rye whiskey. They do that split aging. So the high distillate was 12-year, the low distillate was 6-year, and then they added 8% bourbon. It was likely old granddad that they bought in bulk and added to it, and then 1% sherry.
Wow.
So rather than buy the sherry cask, as expensive that is, and do a finishing in a sherry cask like everybody else did, I'll just dip a little sherry in it.
Yeah,
there you go. You've made yourself
now
the equivalent.
You said something interesting. You as a Canadian, you can't buy this.
No, as a Canadian, I can't buy it, and it was only made a few years ago. I've looked for it in exports. It's not available either. Yeah, if 909 whiskeys are for export only.
Thing. So they don't bother if you're buying it in Canada, it's 100% Canadian.
Yes, they don't. They don't do the 909 thing. It was all about for taxes. Export.
Yeah, but it's weird.
It's typically American. Although the tax rules are gone. Like, the tax rules don't even exist anymore.
I think alcohol is the source of the weirdest.
It's Appalachians in general. Appalachians. Yeah. Yeah. And these arcane rules around what makes champagne champagne what makes bourbon bourbon are so they're antiquated now because those tax laws are gone. And it's weird that you can't buy these in Canada. Would you want to? I mean, would you prefer to buy a 909 in Canada or?
Yeah. Why wouldn't you want to try this? Right. I mean, I just love the idea of, hey, so you know, funny. If you finish this whiskey in a sherry cask, you get a little flavor of sherry. Why do you want to spend all that money on that cask?
Let's just put some sherry in it.
Thanks for playing.
I'm sure there is a difference, but okay.
Needless to say, Canadian whiskey is very popular in America, and it's the primary market for Canadian whiskey. In fact, in the IRI reports from 2019, which is sort of the standard for this business, said the number one whiskey in America, Jack Daniel's, obviously. The number two, Crown Royal.
Huh.
Yeah.
So, it's done very well.
For cocktails. I mean, it's just.
Yeah. By the way, number three was Fireball.
Fireball.
Which originally.
Good if you've Lord. Given up totally, might we recommend
Holy cow.
Fireball?
I also, it was some shame admit, a Fireball originally made by Seagram's in Gimli, Manitoba, acquired by the Sazerac Distillery in Frankfort, Kentucky, is now made in Frankfort, although they still use Canadian whiskey to make it.
Yeah, you have to hold the standard. What, Fireball? God damn
That's
it.
That's whiskey with Fireball. Cinnamon. With
number
case,
three.
In case you're it's under 21, whiskey. It's cinnamon whiskey.
Oh, so gross.
I love it because if you go to the Fireball site, all the other sites, they say, well, what's your birthday? Here they just go, are you 21?
Yeah. Like the circle's not even centered. Yeah.
This is how they brand Fireball. Crazy.
I bet 90% of the sales of this are like the little bottles you get at checkout. Yep. You're like, I don't want anyone to know I'm drinking this.
Well, I bet you number five is that peanut butter whiskey you drink, Paul, to be honest.
Jeez. Sure.
Listen, so Canadian whiskeys don't go after awards. They go after their reasonably priced, good tasting whiskeys.
They're not about awards season.
No,
they're
not a thing.
Not a boot awards. It's so Canadian. No. It's not about boot the awards. So
but in 2016, Jim Murray, who's one of the most respected whiskey specialists in the world, named Crown Royal's Northern Harvest Rye the world whiskey of the year.
Wow.
And by the way, a very nice whiskey. And when you're going to go shopping for Crown Royal, either buy the original or buy this.
Yeah.
Leave all the rest alone. There's like apple versions and maple syrup versions, like some really bad things.
Right.
There's a dark that's pretty good. Traditional Crown Royal, you cannot go wrong with. A little ginger ale, you feel good about it. But here's the funny part. When Yamazaki won the gold medal in 2013, Yamazaki 12 went from a $40 bottle of whiskey to a $400 bottle of whiskey, if you could find one.
Right.
When Crown Royal started making Northern Harvest Rye, it was $30. They won that award. You know how much it is today?
$30. Yeah, good. Good for them,
right? Because they're Canadian. We're not going to awards.
Yeah,
I tell you again.
Good taste in whiskey that you don't feel bad throwing in a cocktail or drinking on its own. They're good either way.
So this is what you would probably use for mixing rather than
be only, but not because it doesn't taste great, because it's just so inexpensive. You don't feel bad about it.
Yeah,
right.
It's ironic because when you're adding ginger ale to whiskey, you're actually making it cost less by stretching it out. Well, oh my gosh, I've lost them both. Well, thank you everybody for joining us. That is and concludes our fabulous edition of Windows Weekly. Maybe our internet went down. I don't know, but that's all right. We got every bit of it out, including the Northern Harvest Rye, our whiskey pick of the week. We do Windows Weekly. Did the Zoom ISO collapse? We do Windows Weekly the Mac rebooted. Okay. That's all right. You know what? Honestly, I think we're done. We do the show every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern.
That is 1800 UTC. If you want to watch us do it live, you can. Live.twit.tv. If you're watching live, you can chat live in our IRC, irc.twit.tv, or in our Club Twit Discord if you're already a Club Twit member. Thank you, Club Twit members, for all you do. We appreciate it. After the fact, on-demand versions of the show at twit.tv/WW. Or you can just make sure you tell those guys I didn't hang up on them, okay? It wasn't me. Or you can go to the YouTube channel. It's a great way to share little clips. But it would be my strong strong recommendation, easiest thing to do, to subscribe. Get your favorite podcast player. We have links at twit.tv/WW to the Google and the Apple one. But there's, you know, and there's many. I use Pocket Cast. A lot of people like Overcast. That's audio only. We do have audio and video versions of the show. But get your favorite podcast client and subscribe. That way, it's just a no-brainer. You don't have to think about it. You'll just have Windows Weekly. Whenever you've got a moment, you want to listen, you got it. And we have the feed for that at the webpage, twit.tv/WW. But frankly, if you just search for Windows Weekly, almost all those podcast clients have a directory, and you can find it very quickly. Search for Twit. Maybe get some other shows, too. Subscribe to them all. You don't have to listen to them. Just subscribe to them. That way you have them. We thank Paul Theroux. He is at Oh, wait a minute. You're back. I did not hang up on you guys. I just want you to know.
We know.
Yeah, that was...
We know what happened, Leo.
The Macintosh just like...
Macintosh
went
crashed.
Around my neck and yanking it,
yeah,
off the
it realized, wait a minute, this is a Windows show. What am I doing here? And then went out. So anyway, I'm glad to get you back. Mr. Theroux is at Theroux.com, Theroott.com. Subscribe to the premium version and you will get some lots of great additional stuff, including chapters from his Windows Everywhere book. That book and the Field Guide to Windows 11 are available at leanpub.com. Thank you, Paulie. Richard Campbell is runasradio.com. He has Run As Radio, but he also has .NET Rocks. If you're a .NET fan, that's a must listen to every week. Anything else? We plug those, but do you have anything else you want to promote, Richard?
No, I'm good. We've got our fall show coming up for Dev Intersection and the Azure AI show. It'll be the first week of December. I'm good. I was supposed to have some announcements in the build timeframe, but politics got complicated. But okay. As soon as I can announce the things we're going to do, we will.
Good.
But yeah, the show's coming up. It'll be a great fall show.
See him in person. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure.
As I know from our Alaska cruise, it was great to have you aboard.
Yeah, thanks. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. You know, I just got a mailing from a company that does small boats that does the inland passages through Alaska.
I thought, wow,
that might be the next step. You know, we've seen Ketchikan and Anchorage and Juneau and stuff, but wouldn't you like to go on the inland passages there? That'd be kind of interesting.
Just see the way they saw it from the water, right? Like, not these big ships.
Yeah, it's a little 76 person boat. They're tiny.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. I'll let you know if we do it. Actually, you know, it'd be fun to take over the whole boat. We could easily have done that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And just say, hey, it's going to be a Windows Weekly cruise, which means Crown Royal for everyone.
Yep. Thank- Go to Quebec City.
Yeah. Yep. They still, now, is beautiful, that is that place. Big fortress, that's not the original fortress you were talking about.
The old walls of the walled city.
Those are still there. Nice.
That's still there, yeah.
No, it's really a nice big hotel. It's fun.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's a Fairmont.
Is it really? I'd like to stay there. What is it called?
The Fairmont.
Just the
Fairmont, Quebec City. Yep.
Oh, that's it. Okay. Thank you, everybody. I want to go to Montreal, too, because I want to try the bagels.
Rich has got me promoting Canada. I don't know what the hell
happened. What is going on? Yeah. Welcome to the Canadian show, eh?
Yep. Yeah. Smoked meat and the Bell Center.
Yep.
Le Habs. Yes. Mushroom real hockey.
I told you.
Now you're in Ontario.
I'm a Quebecois. My forebears, Jacques Delaporte de Saint-Georges, came there in 1693.
I'm also French Canadian. Well,
are you?
My name is French Canadian.
You look French Canadian, actually.
It's from Newfoundland.
Leo Laporte was such a common Canuck name in Providence that when I was a kid growing up there, I looked it up. There were 21 Leo Laportes in the phone book.
Wow.
I presume somehow all related.
But have you watched any Letterkenny?
I don't even know what that is. So clearly,
Letterkenny is a TV show. It's like the Canadian version of Trailer Park Boys.
Right. Oh, I thought Trailer Park Boys was the Canadian version.
This is even more Canadian. This is like interior Ontario. It's hilarious. But they had, and they recently did a spinoff called Shorzy, which is literally just about the hockey players. And that, yeah, if you've ever seen like low budget hockey playing in Canada, Shorzy nails it. Where the tickets are $10 because it comes with a beer.
So it's like a rodeo, but it's on ice.
It's on ice, except far more violent. Than any old rodeo could hope.
Good news, Letterkenny is on Hulu, so I guess I'll be watching.
Watch Letterkenny.
Oh, it looks it too, doesn't it? Wow.
Yeah.
All right. The residents of Letterkenny belong to one of three groups: the Hicks, the Skids, and the hockey players.
Oh boy. So it's just like the British, the French, and whatever else was over there.
That's the Indians, I guess. Constantly feuding with each other over seemingly trivial matters that often end with someone getting their ass kicked. Wow, that looks like entertainment galore.
You know what you do when you're watching that is you drink some Canadian whiskey.
Canadian there Club.
A little Canadian whiskey and a little Letterkenny and you're good.
Yeah, Royal Crown. A Crown Royal. Let's get it right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Paul.
Gimli, Manitoba.
What was the one that they made for the king when he was coming?
That's Crown Royal.
Crown Royal. Okay.
George VI in 1939.
Elizabeth
became Crown Royal.
Father.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. May our supply, as they say, be endless. And this is from Patrick Delahanty, who's an honorary Canadian because he grew up in Maine, which is Canada South.
Close enough.
Yeah.
Way up there, huh?
Yeah. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on Windows Weekly. Bye-bye.
Hey, folks, I'm Matt Pruitt, and I have a question for you. How do you think your hardworking team, with a Club Twit corporate subscription plan, of course, show your appreciation and reward your tech team with a subscription to Club Twit? Keep everyone informed and entertained with podcasts covering the latest in tech. With a Club Twit subscription, they get access to all of our podcasts ad-free. And they also get access to our members-only Discord, access to exclusive outtakes and behind-the-scenes footage and special content like the Fireside Chats that I enjoy hosting. Plus, they also get shows like Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show. So, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and look for corporate plans for complete details.